Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Charlie Sennett of the Ground Truth Project starts things off with progress report, if any, on stopping ISIS in Iraq and Syria and the surreal partisan battle over Ebola. Then our political panel, David Bernstein from WGBH and David Scharfenberg from the Boston Globe. With the first one-on-one gubernatorial debate just a day away right here at GBH, will either Coakley or Baker ever pull away, and will Scott Brown make history? Then how did the Keene, New Hampshire Pumpkin Festival turn into a virtual riot with much damage, injuries, and general chaos?
All revved up, we'll talk the Catholic Church's movement, sort of, on the LGBT issues, and the latest from Ferguson, Missouri, where a white police officer who killed an unarmed black teenager claims he feared for his life. Then, continuing our debates on the ballot questions, today is a showdown on number 4, paid sick leave. Then we'll ask you to weigh in. You for it or not?
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We're starting at 11 because it's 3 hours now.
You know what tomorrow is?
Tuesday.
And what happens
tomorrow? Oh, the big debate. We're doing we're monitoring a debate. No, we're not monitoring. We're moderating a debate
between
Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley. The first one-on-one. It'll be at 7 o'clock on Channel 2.
That's right. And 89.7 FM, the first one-on-one televised debate. You know, in the United States, 40% of unemployed workers are millennials. And the jokes we tell about kids living in their parents' basements is one that would not get lost in translation. It might not get a lot of laughs either, because youth unemployment is a worldwide crisis, a problem that could also be contributing to terrorism, obviously. As part of the Ground Truth Project, which is headed by Charlie Sennett, one of their largest projects is a special report entitled Generation TBD, Despair and Opportunity for Millennials in an Uncertain Global Economy. This Friday, Charlie will be in New York at a conference about the global youth unemployment crisis. In addition to heading up the Ground Truth Project here at GBH, Charlie is also a news analyst here and the co-founder of Global Post. Good to see you, Charlie.
Good to see you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Good morning, Charlie Sennett. Before we get to youth unemployment, which I had no idea was as bad as it is, let's talk a little bit closer to home. James Foley Memorial Mass. Tell us about it.
It was amazing. It was a beautiful celebration of his life. October 18th is Jim Foley's birthday, and it would have been his 41st birthday, and his family celebrated his life in the most extraordinary way. You know, we've talked about this before, about how their faith is the song Amazing Grace?
Yes.
They have Amazing Grace. I mean, they stood online for hundreds and hundreds, probably several thousand people at that church, and really received every single one of them with a smile, with a sense of thank you for coming,
wow,
reaching out to people, telling people how appreciative they are of their support. They're so giving. Their faith is so strong. And we know this by if you've been hearing them, and most people have. There's like 94% recognition of the Jim Foley story in the American news audience. Mm. People know this story. And I think one of the most important things is to know the family's faith, how it really strengthened them. But what was cool about this event was it was all of Jim Foley's families. You know, we think of him as a journalist because we're journalists. Foley went to Marquette, where he was taught by the Jesuits. So the Jesuits loved that he had this social justice spirit in his reporting. He then goes on to Teach for America, where he brings this sense of social justice he learns both from his parents and from the Jesuit school into the world. So all these cool young people from Teach for America were there. Then he goes to Northwestern, where he's an amazing student in digital journalism and working across platforms. Then he goes to UMass, where he picks up a degree in narrative creative writing, and he's done a really significant poetry, which he's won prizes for, which I had no idea about until yesterday. The levels of his family were unfurling at this event in the most emotional and beautiful way. And then, you know, I have to say I was really proud to be there sort of representing the family in the field, the tribe of those journalists who go out, risk their lives to tell these stories, to find ground truth, as we call it. Jim Foley was all about ground truth. And Jim Foley's life and the kind of band of brothers and sisters in the field who are sobered by his death, but inspired by his life, was extraordinary.
Are they inspired enough to be contributing to this memorial fund to benefit
they
other
are.
People
Thanks
like
for
Foley
bringing it
and their
up.
Families?
You know, the Foley Legacy Fund is really important. Yes, you know, isn't it amazing that sometimes the people with the least money in the world are the ones who do the most?
Mm.
No, they're really seeing that even these journalists who are, as we all know, journalism's on hard times. Journalists don't have a lot of money. But, yeah, they are giving, and we're also seeing that there's a big consensus building around a need to do more right now, a need to recognize that this is a perilous moment for reporting in the world. The Foley Legacy Fund is a big part of that. It's a beautiful cause. Ground Truth is trying to be part of that with training and mentoring the next generation, Committee to Protect Journalists. There are several organizations that see this as a moment to galvanize and really say, what can we do to keep this kind of on-the-ground reporting happening, but be sure we do it safely?
And also, they're also looking into, unless I'm incorrect, Charlie, into the whole issue of hostage-taking and how you reconcile trying to rescue someone with the policies of places like the United States.
You're exactly right. The Foley family feels very strongly we need to rethink this policy. Yeah. They're really strong on that.
Well, James Foley, of course, is the person when he was murdered by ISIS who really brought the terror of ISIS to the fore, yeah. And we all discovered them. Last week was a pretty scary week in terms of ISIS, close to Baghdad, you know, taking over this part of this town, Kobani. So this week, anything new? Do we know anything more?
Just more and more bad news. Turkey continues to wait in the wings. I think I wrote my column on that. We talked about it last week. You know, just coming back from Iraq, seeing the Islamic State literally, you know, just across the way in these towns is chilling. And I had the opportunity to see that firsthand, to see a lot of the fighting, these skirmishes, these small little battles that are going on. They continue every day. Little bit of good news around Kobani, little bit of bad news around Kobani. I think it's going to be like this. We're going to see it go back and forth. And as President Obama keeps telegraphing, this is a long fight. This is the long war, just got longer.
Yeah, just one thing about this. And every time I look at you and think, I know I'm overdoing this. Every week I get into this, yeah. But it is true. When you're in places like you were when you called us from northern Iraq and you just left being on the border of a firefight, you get on a plane,
mm-hmm.
and then you're back in Boston and suburban Boston where you live. What's your head like? I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you know, 1 minute you're there, and then 1 minute you're here, you're with your family.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Excuse me, that means he doesn't chase people from here to New Hampshire if they cut him off at the red light? Is that what you're trying to get at?
No,
Jim,
I don't know
like
what I'm
do?
Getting at, but what is
yeah.
that? What is
Go
that?
Ahead, Charlie.
You know, we've talked about this a lot, and I know you have other stuff you want to get to today. There's so many important issues in the world. But briefly, as a correspondent, I feel really lucky to be on the front line of history, to see history with a sort of ringside seat. And that's a privilege and an honor in a time in which journalism is struggling to fund that kind of reporting. And the Ground Truth Project, you know, we're dedicated to just saying, how do we keep this going? The Boston Globe, great newspaper. We love it. But it had to cut its foreign coverage because of the impact economically of the web on journalism. We at Global Post, we started Global Post to try to counter that. Now we started the Ground Truth Project to fund very expensive reporting in the field. Frontline here at WGBH does it all the time. Their series on ISIS is incredible,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but wait a second. I want
to
know about you.
PRI The World does it all
the
time.
We know how great the work is. We do.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you're here. What is it like for you? What is
personally
your,
okay?
No, not being there. But without I asked you last week,
yeah,
being
does he
there
sweat the
and
small
then all of a
stuff?
Sudden you're at a no. deli in your neighborhood. I mean, what is that like?
You could ask my kids if I have little sort of these very light shades of PTSD. You get them absolutely when you're a correspondent and you're in a place where you're afraid. It carries into your life, and I won't hide that from you. It's not anywhere near what the military would uh-huh. experience because remember they are dealing with the idea of they. Are engaging in combat. They are delivering, you know, bullets to the other side. We're watching. It's very different. But I can tell you, we share an element of fear, of being very close to very serious action. I've often had guys, even guys, a guy I know in the Special Forces who lives very near me. We were talking the other day, and he said he couldn't believe some of the battles I'd witnessed. Like, that's stuff that even a veteran in the Special Forces may not get that level of number of experiences. But I can tell you it's very different when you're in the military and you are assigned as a part of that conflict, and when you're a journalist watching it, what we go through is much less, but there are shades of PTSD. And there's one funny story I'll tell you, which is we came off of all these years of reporting. And I say we because my family lived with me over in the Middle East. Our kids were born over there, three of them. We have these four boys. My wife and I just went through all these 8 out of 12 months of the year in Iraq and Afghanistan for 5 years. I was wiped out. The Boston Globe gave me the Nieman Fellowship, right? The most peaceful thing you could do. I study Irish poetry, life drawing. I come down off all the conflict reporting for a while. And we bought a beautiful home out in Harvard, Mass. And I'm sitting there on the front porch with my wife, Julie, on the first day we own the home with our first cup of coffee. And what do I hear over the ridge from Fort Devens? Close air support, 50 caliber machine guns. I can hear mortars being fired. And so I looked over at Julie like with this cup of coffee and said, you hear that, right? Like, I'm not having some weird flashback here. What we've realized is we are attuned to the training at Fort Devens. Every day at Fort Devens, young people are training to go into Afghanistan to risk their lives, right? And hopefully not to go back on the ground in Iraq, but maybe, and maybe it'll need to be done. But what I hear when I'm on our soccer fields and I'm with our kids watching their games, I can hear that on a Saturday morning. It's there. And it interests me that some of the other parents hear it, but many don't. And one of the things in America we forget is that 1% of our population in the military is out there. And we also forget that there are correspondents, a much smaller family, a much smaller percentage. But the people in the field who are correspondents observing that are also out there. And when I hear that sound, yeah, I'm reminded of the service of the military in a way with my Dunkin' Donuts on a soccer field. Others might not be. But I'm also reminded of my friends and my colleagues and this band of brothers and sisters of which Jim Foley was a part, who do this work every day, not just American and British and European, Iraqi journalists, Syrian journalists. These are people who are trying their best to bring us the stories from the field, and we need to hear them.
But you know what I wonder? You know, we've gone through this. We've been very worked up in the United States of America over Ebola. Some would say we've been hysterical over Ebola. And you must have a perspective, having gone to these places where people are seeing their families killed, their villages wiped out. You know, we're supposed to be land of the free, home of the brave. And sometimes I don't feel like we are very brave when we're in a total panic.
Hasn't it been amazing to watch the Ebola crisis turn into partisan politics on the eve of the midterms?
Yes.
It's really been stunning to see how a world health crisis, which deals with issues of the lack of clean water, the lack of development in these countries. Africa is on the edge of great success. It's on the edge of growing its middle class. It's trying very hard through the help of nations like our own that have done a lot of development. And it's doing well on its own because it has thriving businesses. Africa's on the cusp of success. And then along comes this world health crisis. And to see the reaction, instead of it being, what can we do to help? It's this reaction of fear seems very un-American to me. We've always reached out to the world to try to help. Why are we suddenly politicizing this and saying that, you know, that this new czar is a political appointee? Yeah, he is, but he may also be a very efficient manager.
Can I tell you something? I'm so glad you said that. I have rarely been as appalled by the debate. Okay, he doesn't have medical experiences. The assumption is that Barack Obama picked Ron Klain because he's a political hack and doesn't want him to deal with a crisis in America. Enough already. Support the guy. Try to get him to do his job well, to reduce, as you call it, the panic in America, and move on. Everything is partisan. It is staggering to me.
It really is. Now, you guys will be hosting the debate tomorrow night.
Yes,
we will.
This is a time of a political climate where even Jean Shaheen became part of this global debate at the Foley Memorial Service. She was there. And she suddenly, you know, I was watching some of the local media talking with her and the questions about, are we doing enough with the Islamic State? And this is just honoring a kid from New Hampshire, right? I just saw some of the vitriol. You could feel it among the press corps, even there at this beautiful celebration of Jim's life. But with the Ebola thing, I do think it's worth pointing out that it's broken down on these lines of which the Democrats are saying, what happens when you cut funding to the CDC? What happens when you cut all of this foreign aid funding that hurts development, that brings clean water, that allows people to have the access to that water to wash their hands, to stop disease? We need government in order to really approach a lot of the world's very complex problems. And yeah, okay, if the Republican proposal is let's shut down our borders and keep people from West Africa out of here, that's absurd and fearful. And anyone who understands crisis knows fear is debilitating.
By the way, you say absurd, and would you say fearful? I'm betting that before the week is over, the President of the United States buys into that travel ban. I mean, he said he was open to it. He didn't think it was appropriate now. But let's watch, and we'll talk about it next week. Can we move to another thing? The Pope, the Synod just ended. And we're going to talk to the two reverends in an hour or so about the hope that was raised last week and that was arguably dashed, at least in part. When the Pope speaks, arguably the highest profile religious leader in the world, Marjorie's raising this all the time in terms of American presidential politics. What impact does that have around the world and on world leaders? Do people care? I mean, I know they shake their head and compliment it. Does it matter?
Well, you had that amazing discussion right here where the question was raised, did anyone really vet this guy? And she was wonderful talking about, like, here is this effort to reach out across a lot of the culture wars that have made the Catholic Church look very rigid, particularly under Pope Benedict. And say, hey, we got to do more for divorced couples. If you were divorced, you should be able to return to the church. Gay marriage, that beautiful quote from the Pope about who am I to judge. This is a church that is allowing itself to admit that there's an open debate. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to abandon the core traditional values that come with the Catholic teaching. You're a fool if you think that's going to happen. But I thought John Allen in The Globe had a wonderful observation that, okay, they watered it down. They pulled back from a lot of that language because it was a draft document. And the Synod is going to produce a document that will be more in line with some of the conservative teaching that we're used to. But John made the good point that what's happened is a spirit of transparency, of opening up the debate so that people who are Catholic, and I would include myself in this group as someone who grew up Boston Irish Catholic, as wayward as I am and as much as I struggle with it, like just about every Catholic I know, this is a debate that's needed. It's had at every dinner table. It's had at every family gathering. It's had in all the small settings I know where your faith comes up and where these issues are discussed. We need a civil discourse that doesn't go down into base partisan politics where you really talk about a modern world and whether or not that church is going to inform the way you live it. And I think that the Pope has opened that spirit up, and he's done it. I think people listen when the Pope speaks. When he spoke on economic inequality and we were reporting on that, I thought that was resonating. I thought you could really hear people recognizing this is a Pope who understands that the penchant for the poor is embedded in Christ's message, right?
Right.
That's unique. You know, one thing just to shift a little bit. Can I read a quote from Pope Francis
Absolutely.
About youth unemployment?
Oh, yes. Right up your alley, yeah.
So the Pope has been very eloquent on this other big issue we've been looking at the Ground Truth Project. We're doing a big special report, which you gave a wonderful introduction to, called Generation TBD, a special report on Global Post. Big conference that we'll be co-hosting this Friday on it. But the Pope has been way ahead on this. So remember, President Obama gave a speech, was it 2 weeks ago, on the millennials, and he used capital M for millennial in his speech. Not only is it a voting block, it's a generation with a capital M now. So he was behind Pope Francis, though, who much earlier over the summer said about youth unemployment, this is the most serious of the evils that afflict the world these days. Youth unemployment, lack of opportunity, despair. That's the soil in which militancy grows. That's the soil in which despair grows. That's the soil in which all of these problems we struggle with in the world are happening. And so we're at Global Post's, this special report, our team from Ground Truth, we're trying to shape that debate. We got 22 reporters going around the world reporting from 11 countries. This is all up on Global Post and the Ground Truth Project right now. This is a really important debate. You have numbers that are just staggering
like
about the levels.
Give us a couple of examples.
And why?
Okay. So for example, highest youth unemployment, according to the World Bank, in the world is Bosnia. Kind of a surprising one for me. I didn't really think that would be the highest one, but it is. Post-war society, no jobs. They have not integrated well in the aftermath of war. Our tremendous reporter, Elizabeth Herman, who's right from Massachusetts, went to Tufts, brilliant young reporter and photographer, she revealed the stories of a generation that's not only are the 57%, if I'm remembering that number correctly, of those people ages 15 to 24 have no jobs. They don't have anything to look forward to, so many of them are migrating. They're leaving Bosnia. So the ones who do have skills leave. The ones who stay have nothing. But they tend to at least have an opportunity to get into college, and it's this sort of cafe and bar society where no one's doing anything. In that squandered opportunity comes the potential for the resentments of the past in a part of the world that can ignite at any minute back into ethnic conflict. That is just this smoldering problem there. Another one that's really dramatic is Nigeria. So that in Nigeria, the numbers are just slightly less than Bosnia. But what they don't factor in is that Nigeria has a massive group of people who are doing really, really simple little jobs like selling things on the street that they include as a job. So their numbers, by other calculations, are as high as 80% of the young people between the ages 15 and 24 neither have a job nor are in any kind of formal education, not high school or college. So this is a squandered generation. So there's this tattoo that street kids in Nigeria have that says right across their chest, born throwaway.
Oh, man.
And they are sort of embracing this notion that they're a throwaway generation. But with all the despair, with all the violence that this could beget, Nigeria, certainly the militancy of Boko Haram draws on the despair of this generation that has nothing to do. But Marjorie, to your point, what causes this? What causes it is a change in global economy, an economy in which so much of the digital revolution and the technological revolution has shifted the kind of work we do. And it's dramatic. These are big forces at work. We need big, big minds to think through how we're going to even understand the problem before we begin to address it. But I also want to really quickly say, we call it Generation TBD, as in to be determined, because there's incredible opportunity right now. We saw this in Egypt, of all places. The young people who were part of the Facebook revolution, who are really good at social networking and technology, who made a movement happen that toppled a dictator who held for 30 years. What happened afterwards? That's up for grabs. That's still in motion. But what they haven't lost is the energy of innovation that came with that powerful movement of coming together on Facebook pages and through Twitter feeds. And we're seeing great technological innovation in Egypt. And actually, very interesting, a lot of angel investors going into the Middle East, picking up on the Arab Spring, and recognizing there's a movement here, people who understand how to move people toward positive change. So I don't want to call it all doom and gloom. Our great hope is that Generation TBD will be determined as one that also affects change at a time of great change.
Last thing on that, though, I don't want to be doom and gloom either. If you don't want to be it, I don't want to be it. Okay. But I'll be halfway there. You know, we had Naomi Klein the other day, and
yeah,
talking about a new book
about
you know, how much time do we have to begin to fix this climate change nightmare.
It
seems
scary
to me, when you're talking about the kind of numbers you're talking about, 57%, whatever it is,
yep,
I assume the clock's ticking there too. I mean, the 15 or whatever number, 18 to 24-year-olds are going to become 24 to 35-year-olds. And then, so what is, how urgent? I mean, it seems to me the urgency is colossal.
The urgency is extraordinary. World Economic Forum has put this as a priority issue, right up there with income inequality as something that has to be dealt with. And of course, it's woven into the arguments around income inequality, right? But the President of the United States put his finger on it when he said that this millennial generation right here in America, right here in Boston, where we have all these college students, what they face going out into the world is the reality that they may not do as well as their parents. Now, all three
of us, for the first time ever,
all three of us are part of a generation that did do better than its parents. I know that I feel very fortunate that I did. You know, my chance to go to UMass and to go ahead and to get the funding I needed and to be able to work a summer job to pay for it, I don't know that exists anymore. And I think we have to think through opportunities for young people. So our conference on Friday is solutions-based. We're going to thought leaders, great mayors from around the country and around the world. We're bringing in economists. We're bringing in people to really start to focus on solutions to this problem. We hope our journalism at Ground Truth frames the issue. And then we want to convene so that we start thinking about solutions. So, and one solution I see emerging is a sort of return, not just to internships, but to that really old-fashioned apprenticeship. hiring young people for positions where they're going to get trained on the job to do much bigger jobs. And the other one is innovation economy, looking at startups, looking at technology as the way to unleash the talents of young people. And, you know, I was with my Palestinian friend and colleague just recently on this trip. So much despair. We're looking at devastated Gaza. We're looking at the walls of the West Bank. We're looking at all this terrible stuff. He's so depressed. He's had very serious health problems. He's really, like so many Palestinian people, he's really been through trauma, and so many Israeli people too. But I think to live in the West Bank is uniquely difficult. He was so depressed until his son showed up to meet us for coffee, and it was like this light went on in my friend Zaid Ghazali's eyes. His son arrives like anyone would with their son. Son's name is Adam. Adam was talking about his startup, and he's talking about how excited he is about it. And it's a really cool idea. And he said, and we've got Israeli funding, we got some Palestinian funding. And I said, well, isn't that kind of controversial for you coming from the West Bank? And he said, you know what? We're not an Israeli startup. We're not a Palestinian startup. We're not an Israeli-Palestinian startup. We're just a startup. And this quote I loved. He said, you know what? Technology has no checkpoints.
That's a great line. Let's end on an up note, which we almost never do with you, Charlie Sennett. Charlie, great to see you.
Great to see
and
you guys.
People should check out Global Post and Ground Truth Project because it's great, great stuff and with really talented reporters. And you had a great column yourself there, Charlie Sennett. We'll say that as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
Charlie is a news analyst here at WGBH. He's also the co-founder of Global Post and Ground Truth Project. Friday, he'll be in New York at a conference at the International House to discuss what we've just been talking about, global youth unemployment. Charlie, great to see you.
Thanks.
Up next, we're hitting the campaign trail with our weekly political roundup. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. All politics is local today. We've got a governor's race with only, 15 days to go. What will it take for Coker or Baker to break this tie? And normally newspapers dig up dirt on political candidates, not bronze. The Boston Globe discovers congressional candidate Seth Moulton on the North Shore was decorated twice for heroism during battles with Iraqi insurgents. He not only kept this from the press and the public, but from his parents. We're going to talk about that, too. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over local and national politics are David Bernstein and David Scharfenberg. David Bernstein is GBH's political analyst, also contributing editor of Boston Magazine. David Scharfenberg is the politics and public policy reporter for the Boston Globe. David and David, good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Hello there.
So we'll have to do David Scharfenberg from the Globe, David Bernstein from WGBH and Boston Magazine.
That's yeah, can I just comment that Scharfenberg was a terrific sort of colleague of mine when he was writing for the Providence Phoenix, which just folded, just printed its last issue.
Sad to see it.
It is very sad, and we still miss the Boston Phoenix terribly here. But anyway, the Globe is still in business, and you guys on Friday had a poll showing the race neck and neck. I think it was 41-41.
That's right.
So is anything going to happen here to break this? Can we hope for some momentous event, or are we just going to slide rather not that excitingly into Election Day?
David Scharfenberg.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the headlines in the next few days. But no, this thing has been close for a long time and seemingly will remain that way. I think the Democrats are hoping that if it is this razor-thin a margin heading into Election Day, that their ground game will give them a point or two and put them over the top. I mean, I tend to think the ground game is overrated, but if it's super close, they're hoping that edge will put Martha Coakley in the corner office. We'll see.
You're David Bernstein, correct? I just want to make sure which one. Okay, that's fine. David Bernstein.
We switch identities.
Why is this so close? Because ideologically, the public is divided because of the gender gap, or because they're both being very careful and not taking many risks?
What I think a lot of it is, part of it is that the sort of lack of enthusiasm generally about the election means a little bit smaller electorate, which means a lot of the sort of solid Democrats, what I think of as the gateway city Democrats, minorities, young progressives in places like Lawrence and Springfield and Chelsea and Fall River are not expected to show up in big numbers.
Springfield's not going to vote with the casino thing on the ballot?
We'll see. Uh-huh. We'll see. If they do, it becomes a little bit of a different election. But I think that the big thing and the thing to watch going forward is we've got a surprising number of undecideds at this stage of a race between two very well-known candidates for a very high-profile election. And what appears to be the case, and I think that, you know, while they define it differently, both of the campaigns see it essentially this way, is you've got a lot of an awful lot of people out there who, and I've had conversations with them, and I know people at the Globe have, you have these conversations with people who, when they talk about the race, it sounds like they are leaning towards voting for Charlie Baker. But then at the end of the conversation, they say, but, you know, I always vote for the Democrats, so I don't know if I can really vote for him. And what we're waiting to see is whether those folks are going to come back home to the Democrat or whether they're going to sort of give themselves permission to vote for the Republican. That's the way I see it right now.
Well, one thing David Scharfenberg from the Boston Globe, Jim and I argue about in a nice way, of course, is the impact on Charlie Baker of the sweetheart thing. He thinks there's not going to be much of anything. I think that there are people that really don't pay that much attention to the race at all. And women, that the cliche of this race is that women need to go to Baker in greater degrees than they had before for him to beat Martha Coakley. I don't know. If you're not paying attention, but you remember that sweetheart thing, that could be something that the undecided women go into the voting booth with a resentment about.
We'll see. I think we did a kind of man on the street story afterwards that found it having less of an impact than we might have imagined. But you know, it's man on the street. Who knows how widespread it'll be. But, you know, I think that gender gap is going to be huge here. I did a piece a few weeks back. I mean, literally every significant Massachusetts race in recent memory has come down to, can the Democrat beef up the margin among women and hold down the Republicans' margin among men, or can the Republican do the opposite? I mean, that's the ball game right there. That decides the election. I mean, there's obviously various ways to slice and dice the electorate, but that's one way to do it. You know, one thing that Charlie Baker has going for him is that Deval Patrick was literally a rock star among women voters. I mean, he did better than Elizabeth Warren among women voters.
24-point margin.
Martha Kulke's not going to match that. I mean, I think in the latest poll I saw, she was up 11 points among women, which is solid. But Baker starts with an advantage there. I mean, when he went up against Deval Patrick, he went up against the women's candidate. and he lost by women, and he lost women, and he lost the election. He's going to do better among women this time around. We'll see if he can drive up the margins among men.
Yeah, but that's it is amazing to me. I understand how good and appealing Deval Patrick was, their candidate, in a lot of ways. But Martha Coakley happens to be a woman. And ordinarily, I would say that's not that determinative. But when you have a state that has such a pathetic record of electing women to high office, maybe broken up a little bit with Elizabeth Warren and that sort of thing, and the fact that we've never had a woman governor elected, I would have assumed, and been wrong, David Bernstein, that was going to cause fence-sitting women to say, well, even though I'm not crazy about her, I want to make history. That apparently seems to be having negligible impact, if any, right?
So far. I mean, we'll see. Like I said, you've got a pretty big chunk of those undecideds who are women. It tends to be, you know, and the people I'm talking about in particular who are sort of, they voted for Elizabeth Warren, they voted for Deval Patrick, they voted Democrat in the last several elections, and now they are deciding whether to stay with the Democrat or not do it. And her being a woman and, you know, the sorts of sweetheart things, if there's enough there to sort of pile up, that could be part of what brings them back. You know, part of what Elizabeth Warren had, aside from being a woman, was that it was a Senate race. It's a federal race. People, women in particular, these, you know, sort of middle of the road women, are terrified of Republicans in Washington. You know, so it plays into the Senate races and congressional races. It's harder for Coakley to take advantage of that in a gubernatorial race. I think she needs to connect it more on issues the way that Deval Patrick did, you know, but he just had a real gift for doing that.
I'm not going to argue against myself now, having just said that the sweetheart thing could be a factor among women.
I mean, well, you changed your mind. That was like 2 minutes ago.
I haven't changed my mind, but these other things, you know, think about Deval Patrick's attraction to women, you know, except when he's mad at you, and he's been mad at me several times, but he can be a very warm and fuzzy guy, and you think of him as a really good husband. Charlie Baker has gone out of his way to look like husband and father of the year.
Absolutely.
And if that, you know, he wrote the other day, I think it was in Yvonne Abraham's column when he did this thing about questions about, you know,
the Proust questionnaire.
That's right, the Proust questionaire. And love of his life is his wife, Laura.
By the way,
and
every single one of them, they've had four,
I know.
Everyone says their spouse is the love
of
their
life.
Of
course they do, but there's something very almost Leave It to Beaverish about Charlie Baker that could have an attraction again to those undecided women. I'm out here in the ether, but I mean, I think that a lot of people don't pay close attention to the issues, frankly.
See, it seems to me, David Scharfenberg, the best thing, I've only been saying this for a year, so why not say it for two more weeks, that the best thing that Charlie Baker's got going for him in a close election is 10% undecided in your poll, 8% for the three independents. And I assume some of them will lose ground, the independents, because people are going to want to vote for somebody who's going to win. I think the strongest argument he's got is the Mitt Romney argument of 2002, the Gang of Three kind of thing. He doesn't call it the Gang of Three. He calls it they're all on the same team thing up there.
Jim,
and it seems what?
You didn't give him a chance to respond to my Husband of the Year.
Oh, do you want to do that?
Yes, I do. I
okay,
mean, I
then
some
fine,
of these things,
it.
Some of the, I mean, you're a man.
I am.
I'm a woman, the only one in the room, and I'm telling you, these things
okay,
appeal to women.
Forget my question,
what
David
Charlie. We can get to your question in a second. What do you think, Dan?
You know, I think it depends on the woman who's listening.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Charlie Baker had an event, kind of a Women for Charlie event a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he had lots of women in the room who support him, who were oohing and aahing over talk of his family, and I think he was being genuine about it, and I think that does matter. I think there are women who look at that and say, really? That's what you're trying to appeal to me
you
on?
Took you took a lot of grief on that,
yeah,
too,
so
didn't
it depends.
He?
I mean, yep. I think it depends on the woman. You know, ultimately, you know, party affiliation matters more than anything on who you vote for. I mean, Charlie Baker's winning Republican women like 90% to 10% right. or something.
All seven of them, correct?
Yeah, right. So what were you asking?
Oh, so I was saying, I mean, this Gang of Three thing that Mitt Romney used against Shannon, and Shannon O'Brien's a regular guest here. She admits it was very effective in 2002. All Democrats don't want a Republican. He calls it they're all in the same team thing. It seems to me if you're part of the 10% undecided, who hasn't been convinced yet that Charlie or Martha is the cure for what ails Massachusetts or what concerns you, then you're fertile territory for that argument. Aren't you saying, let's have a little balance? We're not going to have any balance anywhere else unless Richard Desai wins on the North Shore. Isn't that a powerful argument?
Oh, I mean, we're sort of in the age of the outsider here in Massachusetts politics. I mean, everyone who's run for governor going back to the 60s is trying to posit themselves as the outsider.
Somebody. Martha Coakley's done tried to do that.
Exactly. Exactly. She's the best-known politician in Massachusetts, and she's positing herself as the outsider. And it's not as illegitimate as it sounds. She's a prosecutor. She's not the most beloved figure on Beacon Hill. But for a Republican, you're automatically an outsider, right? I mean, Charlie Baker has worked on Beacon Hill for years. He was in the Weld and Cellucci administrations. He knows that place really well. I mean, that's a strength of his. But just by being a Republican, he is an outsider. And people like outsiders, and they like balance. So, yeah, that's a strong argument of his.
Don't you think that, David Bernstein, it's a good campaign ender?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, you know, something that he's been trying to push, and the campaign has been trying to push and will continue. I think it's having less traction maybe than it has in other years.
Why?
You know, I think part of it is that people do feel like Martha Coakley is an outsider. You know, that they're both sort of insider-outsider types. There's not as big a gap between them as, for instance, when Mitt Romney was running against Shannon O'Brien. You know, for whatever reason, perceptually, it doesn't feel that way. But also, I don't quite know what it is, but for some reason, no matter what happens lately on Beacon Hill, nobody seems to resent Beacon Hill the same way that they say they do. But then when you really get down to it, you know, and I think the Globe had in its poll a few weeks ago looking at that the numbers, and it was sort of surprisingly soft in terms of how angry they are at Beacon Hill. They think they're all, you know, criminals and crooks, but whatever, you know, it's all right.
We're talking with David Bernstein from WGBH and Boston Magazine, David Scharfenberg from the Boston Globe. You know, David Scharfenberg mentioned David Bernstein a couple minutes ago, the whole ground game thing. John Walsh was in the paper. He's the supposed genius of the Democratic get-out-the-vote stuff. Baker's made this big thing about having a much more sophisticated ground game this time around. John Walsh dismissed it. The Democrat is, you know, forget about it. Is there a Baker ground game that could eat into this Democratic vaunted machine?
It's better than it has been, you know, from my observation, from what I can tell. It is significantly improved over the past, but the past has been so bad, you know, even when they've bragged about it, it's turned out to be horrendous. And it's very tough for the Republicans to really have an effective ground game in this state. I think that Baker has put attention to that. The question that I think the other David was alluding to a little bit ago about the overrating of the effectiveness of it, I think that particularly on a statewide basis, and I think that it's possible or that's now baked into our polling. You know, the effect that it has on turnout,
the ground game,
the ground game, yep, is now sort of baked into the turnout numbers and, you know, and models and so forth. And that may, for the most part, be baked into the numbers.
And the, for what David's talking about, David Bernstein, in the old days, used to say turnout can add 3 points or 4 points, good turnout, to the number you have in polls. But you're saying that's picked up by decent pollsters in this thing, yeah.
That at this point, you know, the who you include in likely voters might now include a greater percentage of minorities.
Although it's interesting, Steve Gazzella over at Mass Inc. Polling Group just put out a blog post this morning talking about how polls here and nationally tend to overestimate how Republicans will perform by a couple of points.
Really?
Maybe the Democrats have a good turnout operation. Maybe it's other factors. But so in that case, a tie might advantage Coakley a little bit.
So if I can summarize this discussion on the race, either Martha Coakley's definitely going to win or Charlie Baker's definitely going to. Is that pretty much where we are?
As long as we've got clips that we can save for after the fact, right, that either way.
Right. And by the way, we should say the first one-on-one televised debate in the race for governor will be tomorrow night here at GBH, co-sponsored by the Boston Globe. And Marjorie and I are moderating 7 o'clock on Channel 2.
7 o'clock.
And right here on 89.7.
Right here on 89.7.
Will make all the difference.
That's
we
right.
hope so.
That's it. We're talking politics with WGBH's David Bernstein and the Boston Globe's David Scharfenberg. We're going to keep talking politics. Up next, stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're talking politics with the Boston Globe's David Scharfenberg and WGBH and Boston Magazine's David Bernstein. You know, there was a story in the Globe, speaking of Globe, David Scharfenberg, about Seth Moulton. We've had both of them in here. Seth Moulton is a Democrat who beat John Tierney, running for John Tierney's seat. Obviously, the Republican is Richard to say. There was a story in your paper. You want to give the sort of summarize it for people who didn't see it this weekend about his decorations for heroism in Iraq?
Sure. Walter Robinson, who's sort of a legendary investigative reporter for the Boston Globe, back after being gone for a little bit, the paper looked into his military record. And while we've seen other candidates fall for kind of exaggerating their military honors, he found that Seth Moulton had actually underplayed what he'd done, that he, as I think you said in the open, hadn't even told his parents about a couple of significant commendations he'd gotten for battles in Iraq. And seemed to get kind of choked up in his interview with our reporter talking about those. So it's, you know, it's a good story for him, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, reminds people of his service, which is a big part of his biography.
Bronze Star Medal for Valor and the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal for Valor. I mean, it is so unusual. I can't think of another politician. Walter Robinson was legendary for exposing these politicians. Remember John Lakin, a gubernatorial candidate, yep, Republican, who lost the primary after Walter's stories about his exaggerations. Royal Switzer had been a state representative. There were a lot of these.
How about the guy in Connecticut just elected the U.S. Senate, Blumenthal, former attorney general, who talked about his combat service in Vietnam when he didn't have any, and he was elected anyway.
So, I mean, you're so startled by this story. I wonder if this is going to turn into any votes for Moulton or not going to turn into any votes for Moulton.
Yeah, I don't know that it necessarily turns into any votes, but it certainly does, I would imagine, help inoculate him against attacks, you know, in the last couple of weeks, you know, whatever attacks, you know, that are coming from Tissay, because he just seems like such an honorable guy. You know, how can you attack him? So it certainly helped. I think the entire thing was just an orchestration to make all the rest of the journalists in Boston feel that we're still so inferior to Walter Robinson, you know, after he's been, like, retired out of the game for all these years, and then he comes back and, like, you know, just kills us on this great story.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that note, actually, that's a perfect segue
to my next thing.
What's that?
He's a scary guy.
Hey, Walter?
What did Brian McGorry say? The scariest moment wasn't about Robinson, but it could have been the scariest moment in any politician's life is when they pick up the phone.
And it's Steve Kirchen.
It's Steve Kirchen on the other end of the
room.
Exactly.
Yeah, Walter's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, speaking of how journalists have performed, though, on Friday I did on NECN the only debate between Brian Herr, the Republican, and the Democrat, obviously the incumbent, Ed Markey. And in the spirit of full disclosure, a spirit I embrace as infrequently as possible, I have made fun of the Republicans running with Republican leaders here. Some of them couldn't even name all the Republicans. Brian Herr, I'm not endorsing any of it. Brian Herr is a credible, smart, thoughtful guy. And when I called Marjorie after the debate and I said, you know what conclusion I draw this? The reason Republicans have no chance in any of these races is because we say they have no chance in any of these races. If her and other people, I assume there are other hers out there, H-E-R-R is his name, had gotten reasonable play in the press here and we not conclude, well, Ed Markey's going to win in a walk, which he may, the Republicans may have had a chance beyond Charlie Baker and Richard to say. Is that an unfair accusation, do you think, David Scharfenberg?
No, I don't think it's unfair. I mean, I think that's a very reasonable critique. We've heard it before, and we'll hear it again, and with good reason. There are a few races, I think, that haven't gotten the buzz we thought they would. I mean, I remember when the casino measure got on the ballot, we're all like, oh, this is going to, the governor's candidates would be competing for attention. Yep. And, it's completely flat. I mean, when have you heard about that last? The poll numbers are cavernous, and no one seems to be all that geared up about it. And, it's obviously a very different kind of thing, but this Senate race has not attracted a lot of attention either. I mean,
Attorney General, too. I mean, when Warren Tolman was running against Maura Healey, and I agree, he's sort of two stars in the Democratic Party, it was virtually, it in many ways, eclipsed the primaries for governor, even the Democratic primary in some people's mind. Have we heard a peep about the race between this is hard. Is it, what's his name? Is
John
it
Miller?
Miller, the Republican who's running against him.
No, Herman? And I'll point also to Heffernan, who's running for treasurer as a Republican, who is a perfectly sharp, credible guy running for an office that Republicans can be very competitive in. The one defense I would make, aside from the fact that all of political media, local media is triaging what we can cover because there's just so little of it left. So you do have to triage. But the other thing is that it's been abundantly clear from very early on and throughout which candidates party insiders, not just here but nationally, believe have any kind
That's
of chance.
That's a very good point.
And,
yeah.
And when you see that, a Heffernan and a Herr and a Miller are not raising any money at all. And a Patricia St. Aubyn, who's running for auditor against Suzanne Bump, who had a big story in the Globe, about a lawsuit against her, still only able to raise, a couple thousand dollars. That tells you that their own internal polls and belief and knowledge about the candidate is telling their national infrastructure that they're not worth investing in.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know anything about this guy. Who's the guy that you said was a credible Republican? Heffernan.
Heffernan.
And by the way, I did a debate in the race. He was very credible there, too, against Deb Goldberg and the Independent.
When I tuned in to that debate that you did between the Senator Markey and this guy, Herr, because there is this idea that a lot of these Republicans in Massachusetts are kind of be way out there and a little odd and doing strange things.
And inferior candidates.
And this guy looked right at Markey every time he criticized him. I would say he throttled Markey in the debate, and it was really incredible.
I don't know about that, but he held his own at least.
I would say he would because he was much more aggressive. I mean, you can be the aggressor as a challenger, but to be right next to somebody and to be that walk that line between aggression and being rude and obnoxious is pretty skillful.
I agree.
One of the things that I got to give Charlie Baker and some of his allies in the party here credit for is they clearly had a deliberate strategy very early on of wanting to have not credible in the sense of being able to win, but in the sense of being able to stand up there and not embarrass the party, candidates for all of the major statewide offices. And they went out of their way to recruit and promote and get, nominated by the party people who are, because otherwise you end up running the risk of you have some crazy tea partier who says, I'll just jump on the ballot.
And it taints everybody.
And then you have to be running away from his crazy comments. And and they did a good job of getting pretty solid,
I will say that,
candidates.
Obviously a very credible guy, did take positions that are not terribly popular in Massachusetts in
like
a lot of cases,
like repealing Obamacare and that sort of thing.
There's a reason Charlie Baker, who was also very credible last time around, lost, and that was in part because he was, playing to the right. It was in the midst of the Tea Party surge, and he made a decision there. So, that is going to come back to bite some of these.
Right, I'm not saying the positions are in step, but I guess I was trying to say is competent, smart, credible, again, they may be out of step on some issues, but the reality is they're far more competent than the coverage would suggest.
Yep.
Somebody who, a Republican who does have a real shot, what's your take on the status of this Brown Shaheen thing? And by the way, my former other employer, NACN, has a debate tomorrow night live with Chuck Todd doing it up there in New Hampshire, by the way, right after we do a gubernatorial debate here. What's your sense of where that is, David Scharfenberg?
It's very close. Very close. I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, just to get a sense for the difference in dynamic between the two states. You had Mitt Romney go up and do a big public rally on Scott Brown's behalf and then come down here and do a very quiet fundraiser for Charlie Baker the next day. I mean, that tells you about the difference in demographics in those two states and why Scott Brown has a real shot. I mean, Charlie Baker has a real shot here, too. But, you know, it's close. I mean, it's interesting to see essentially Jean Shaheen is running for mayor of New Hampshire, right?
Yeah. She's,
she is emphasizing all the local issues as much as she can, and Scott Brown's trying to make it as much about Washington and Barack Obama as he can, and that's just been the drumbeat, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks now. We'll see which one prevails.
Well, that's the ad, by the way, that I'm told by John Carroll is playing in many, many states when someone's close to they do that spelling bee thing we've only seen 10,000 times. Mm-hmm. How do you spell Shaheen? O-B-A-M-A. I think it's actually a pretty effective ad.
So Shaheen's going after Scott Brown now on the abortion front, and he's called her out against him despicable. Does this gain any traction? Is this going to be one of those things that can matter?
She wants to make sure that Democrats stay home, particularly women, stay home with her and her party. You know, it depends on how effective it is. And you know, I thought that a couple of years ago we saw Elizabeth Warren show how to do it effectively against Scott Brown by not sort of going over the top on it. She was helped by the fact that the People's Pledge, so you didn't have the outside groups who don't get the tone that's necessary in a state. So she got to handle it herself. And I thought Elizabeth Warren was very effective doing it one-on-one in debates rather than, you know, over the airwaves. Shaheen may not have that luxury, and we'll see whether it's effective that way.
You know what's unbelievable? Just as a backbencher in the state Senate, Scott Brown ran as the 41st vote to overturn Obamacare, the biggest issue then, and now he's in a race that could determine who controls the United States Senate. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable.
Right place,
great
right
to see
time.
You both, gentlemen.
David Bernstein is WGBA's political analyst. He's also a contributing editor at Boston Magazine. David Scharfenberg is the politics and public policy reporter for the Boston Globe. David and David, thank you very much for coming in. Up next, the college kids of Keene, New Hampshire have put Gallagher to shame. How the Pumpkin Fest became a smashing disaster is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Kicking off hour two of today's BPR with this question. How did the Keene, New Hampshire Pumpkin Festival turn into a virtual riot with property damage, injuries, and general chaos? Then Bob Thompson on HBO and CBS going to online streaming. Is cable TV on its last legs? And speaking of death, why is The Walking Dead so huge? Then we'll hear his best and worst TV moments of the week.
And all revved up, we'll talk about the Catholic Church's movement, sort of, on LGBT issues, and the latest from Missouri, where a white police officer who killed a black teen claims he feared for his life. Then continuing our debates on the ballot questions, today is a showdown on ballot question number 4, paid sick leave. And we'll ask you to weigh in. You for it or not? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. This is hour number 2.
Yes, it is, Marjorie. You know, over the weekend in Keene, New Hampshire, they had their annual Pumpkin Fest and was taken over, as you know, by bands of rowdy students from Keene State University and some others. Cars were flipped, street signs were torn down, fires burned in the street. At least 20 people, actually, I think more, were injured. Dozens of people were arrested. And for all the destruction and melee, we want to know from you, is any of this a surprise? Is this a time of life when all judgment, all understanding of actions and consequences gets overwritten by wild behavior? Is it hormones? Is it a sense of invincibility? Is it drugs or alcohol? Or is just this display of total disrespect? Our number is 877-301-8970. What explains phenomena like this? Did you act like this as a kid when you were that age? Do you have insight into the rowdy, let's call them impulses and actions of college-age kids. If you've watched or seen these reports, I assume you have, the behavior is appalling. And it was not just one or two people. And by the way, let's be clear, some of them were Keene State students, some were not, yep, out-of-towners. But the behavior was nauseating and infected large numbers of people. Read the appalling quote from that, I think he's an 18-year-old in that story in a second. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Here it is.
What's the quote?
Here it is.
What's the guy's name? Read his name.
His name is Stephen French. He's 18 years old. This is what he told the newspaper. It's expletive deleted wicked. It's just like a rush. You're revolting from the cops. It's a blast to do things that you're not supposed to do. So there you go.
Did you do anything? I mean, did you do anything of a comparable nature?
Well, you did.
When you were in college?
No, I did not.
I did. I didn't do anything this bad.
You're talking about Wheels Markell and the pile of
whatever. I did some things that I am not, I'm not proud of. But, you know, it is amazing that there is this level of colossal disrespect for your neighbors, for the safety of others. And what a lot of people are trying to do is saying not just that drinking alcohol is okay, but that it's just the alcohol. Drank too much, they either got stoned, whatever it was, and they engage in this wildly antisocial behavior. But it's really troubling.
As you said before, I mean, throwing bottles at EMTs and throwing bottles at cops, I mean, it's really kind of over the top. We're a college town. You don't see this going on.
Pushing over light posts that, by the way, could have killed somebody,
but
came down.
There was a fascinating piece in Salon talking about the secret attraction of binge drinking. We've talked about binge drinking before. And you know, one of the things about the drinking age being 21 when you're in college is that you have to go through all these hoops to get liquor, fake IDs, and get your friends out to buy the booze for you. It becomes a kind of a cat and mouse game with the college. And the other thing is that what kids do is they get really sauced before they go to an event so that they're drunk by the time they get there. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing the much more normal thing, which is to go to the event, start drinking at the event and have, you know, maybe you'll still get drunk, but you'll spread it out over time so you're not like totally wasted. But this piece talks about the fact that there's a huge attraction to being totally wasted, which is not new. It has nothing to do with the drinking age, which is the old stories about breaking down social barriers, making it easier for you to pick up women or be with men or have fun and share these great adventures.
Yeah, but all that's true. By the way, I agree with all that. However, does that lead you to totally cross the line? I acted irresponsibly plenty of times. Mm-hmm. I never did anything even remotely close to this kind of
thing.
Unusual. It's not unusual. Marjorie, follow these championships that happen. If your team loses, you riot and you push over cars. If your team wins, you celebrate. You push over cars and you light cars on fire. I'm not saying it's an epidemic, but it is not that wildly aberrational.
Well, there was another factor here, too. I mean, remember the last World Series in Boston after the first tragic World Series where
the young woman was killed.
Victoria Snellgrove was killed. Absolutely awful. The next time around, the cops were really well prepared. There's a sense here that the cops were sort of outnumbered. There were thousands of people rioting and maybe not so many cops initially anyway as there should have been. And that might have been one of the problems. But it is unusual because we are in a college town, Jim. We don't have, you know, Boston College, Big Eight or Big Ten, whatever they are. They're a big deal football
Neither,
team up
but
there.
It's okay.
Whatever they are. What are they up there?
I don't know.
Big East?
ACC?
I don't know what they are.
Something.
They're
a
huge football team.
Okay.
And you don't hear stories, even in Brighton, where people have to put up with these kids doing things on their lawn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
How about UMass Amherst a month or two ago?
Yeah, they had an incident up there at UMass
Amherst.
Yeah, you're
a pretty
absolutely
big
right.
time
they
incident.
Did. But I still think this is the exception.
Okay, fine. Let's assume you're right. It's the exception. Even if it's the exception, it happens not that irregularly. Mm-hmm. What happens in the brain of an otherwise responsible, I'm not talking about an anarchist who tries to incite this stuff, an otherwise responsible 18-year-old that causes him or her to think this kind of behavior is defensible, acceptable, whatever the word is. By the way, it's not just teenagers. Listen to this.
A lot of them get so drunk, they don't know what they're doing.
Did you ever get really drunk when you're in college?
No.
Well, you got really stoned when you're in college?
Yes.
Did you do anything like that even marginally comes close to this?
Well, I've always been kind of cautious.
Fine. And I'm moderately cautious. And again, I've done irresponsible things that I want to talk about, even though you will prod me. And I'm serious. But nothing
in
its worst
Wheels Markell story.
Do you know that Wheels Markell went on to become the Secretary of Education for the state of Virginia?
It's great. You could blackmail him, Jim.
Whatever. Listen to this. This just shows how out of control this whole thing. Saturday night, there's this newscaster up there. His name is Jared Goodell.
Oh, this is great.
Had this contentious interview with the Keene Pumpkin Festival organizer. Her name is Ruth Sterling. And by the way, that's why they were all there for this Keene Pumpkin Festival. Goodell was at the festival for Cheshire TV, it's called. And as Goodell tried to interview Sterling, the organizer of the festival, Sterling kept grabbing for Goodell's microphone and tried to hijack the interview. Listen.
Now Ruth Sterling, who is the festival coordinator, is on site here and is being, she's not letting me do my job and to report to you. She would not like me to tell you what is going on at Keene State College. Now I'm being called a free stater.
A family-friendly event. The footprint of Keene Pumpkin Festival is 100% safe. We have a bigger crowd than we've ever had. I want them to have a wonderful evening and not be disturbed by people who aren't even at the Pumpkin Festival. So if you think that inciting these people is a good idea, I am going to pull the plug on you.
And by the way, at the end of the interview, Ruth Sterling hit Jared Goodell over the head with a bottle. Actually, that part's not true. Well, I don't know if it's true. 877-301-8897. That really doesn't relate to the central core, to the core of our discussion. But it just, I mean, talk about denial. This woman is, as they say, the queen. 877-301-8970. And if you were either of that age, or if you were of that age, which I guess if you're older, by definition, you were, did you ever have a moment like this? And if you did, explain to us what snaps, what's the thing that happens that causes, again, an otherwise relatively peaceful, relatively normal, relatively socially responsible and law-abiding kid to become what these kids became up there. Laura, you're in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
My son came home from Pumpkin Fest early on Saturday morning. As he said, it was getting completely out of hand. I thought he was going up to carve pumpkins and eat apple pie and go on hay rides. I had no idea it was this kind of festival.
How old is your son?
He's 20.
Well, you know, this is perfect. And so he decided, as a responsible 20-year-old, that's not the kind of place I want to be.
I think he thought it was getting dangerous.
So had he been there before, Laura?
No.
No. So when he wanted to go there, what did he think he was going to?
I think he knew that he was going to a big party.
Okay.
I think he let me believe that he was going to something very wholesome.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that at all. And when he came home, he looked frightened. He looked scared. But then he was showing me pictures on his phone of the same pictures that ended up in the Globe and on other social media sites that his friends had taken. So his friends were right in the heart of it, you know, standing on cars and that were flipped over.
Do you know any of these friends?
I do.
So if I had said to you on Thursday that, let's call them John and Joe, the friends of your son, are going to be standing on cars and participating in essentially what is rioting, would you have said that's possible, that that's even part of who they are?
No.
So what happened, do you think? What does your son think happened to these people?
I think we both think that a large part of it has to do with the glorifying of these exaggerated events on social media, that you're sort of glorified and publicized when you do something really, really outrageous.
That's an interesting...
I think if they couldn't share this stuff, if they just came home and told the story, it wouldn't have the same impact as the photographs and the tweets and the Facebook stuff.
Very insightful,
you know,
Laura. That's
a great point.
Laura,
that
thanks for the call.
You can show off your antics, your bad antics to all your friends and kind of look cool, because that is a great point.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is, does it occur to any of these people that that may compound the difficulty you're going to find yourself in? I understand. I think Laura makes a great point. But again, you tweet the photograph, you put it up on Facebook, you're basically saying, here's the evidence that I am one of the guilty players. Does that occur to these people?
I think that if you are a regular non-alcoholic person, you know, you probably wouldn't do these things unless you were really, really drunk. And I think that the binge drinking has got a lot to do with it. Getting so sauce, you know what you're doing, you don't care what you're doing, and it's just sort of this big bacchanal.
Why don't you ask me about Wheels Markell again?
Yeah, why don't you? Well, you experienced some heavy drinking in college.
No, it was not heavy. That's absolutely untrue. Wheels may have, and I choose not to tell you about it. Let's go to...
There was a big pile of coats.
There
that's
was,
what I know.
Under which
some was
wheels may
the
have
coats.
Been found at some point, but that's for another day. Bill, you're in Sudbury.
Actually, I think a gym was found under the pile
no,
of coats.
Actually,
it keeps blaming
not.
On that's wheels.
Fine. Bill in Sudbury, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, good afternoon.
And to you.
I have two college-age daughters, and I asked them this morning pretty much the same question that you're asking, and they gave me an interesting answer.
What?
They told me that it's their last chance to be wildly irresponsible, and that soon, before you know it, you have a job, you have car payments, you have a wife, and you can't be wild and crazy anymore. So people view their college years as almost like they missed out if they aren't part of something like this.
Well, you know, Bill, that is exactly one of the points that this guy made in Salon.com, doing all this research on the attraction of binge drinking. Exactly that. You all set out together, you and all your buddies, for a wild night. The next morning you wake up and you feel terrible, but you survived it all together. You can tell these great stories, and you'll be telling them like Jim Browdy is for the rest of his life about Wheels Markel. So there's this big, you know, this is party hardy time. Exactly.
Yeah, but Bill, I hope the end of that sentence was that you said to your kids, or they said back to you, however, party hardy, but don't cross the line and throw bottles at cops and turn over cars and that sort of thing. Yes, or is that included as part of the wild and crazy behavior?
The end of their statement was that teen is kind of known as a wild drinking party school, and that's why they didn't choose to go there.
Oh, well, that shows good judgment on their part. I didn't know that, but maybe it is. Maybe it is not. Bill, thank you for the call.
You know, one of the things in the same piece, and I remember my kids learning this in high school, that you want to have not necessarily the designated driver, although you do want the designated driver if anybody's got a car, but the sort of buddy that's going to kind of vow to remain reasonably sober so that...
And hopefully have an impact on you mean?
Yes, especially with young women, because, of course, what happens in a lot of these situations everybody's really sauced is the sexual attacks, and you want to make sure you don't leave your girlfriends alone with anybody that they don't know. You know, you have to watch out for each other.
I understand. That's a good idea.
That's a great.
Do you know that I got a job? I don't know. Did I tell you I got a job in Keene, New Hampshire, New Hampshire Legal Assistance when I was a young legal services lawyer? Yeah.
Were you there for the Pumpkin Fest?
No, I drove up. I did an interview. I got the job. I'm living in New York City at the time, and I drove and I accepted it. And as I'm driving back, I thought about the culture shock. I'm so sort of a city boy. And Keene, if you haven't been there, I don't know what it's like in 2014, but a couple of decades ago, it was a rather isolated small town. Uh-huh. The guy who hired me said, by the way, you only go to court a couple of months a year. Do you know why? Because you're snowed in.
Oh, snowed
in? For the
in?
Other nine. And when I thought about that, I said, that may not be exactly what I'm looking for. Let's go to Greg. You're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Greg.
Hey, Greg. I'm Greg, and I live in New Hampshire half-time.
Yeah.
I'm very familiar with Keene State, but I wanted to draw sort of a contrast between 40 years ago when I was an undergraduate at a state university in Ohio, the year after Kent State.
Oh, wow.
Our idea of a protest was going to Washington to march against the war, not to go to a pumpkin festival and raise hell. And it's quite discouraging, and we were getting real bullets. So it really is very discouraging to think that that's the best thing you can find to do up in New Hampshire. Is raise hell at an event like that.
Yeah, you know, I also think that that there was a whole, you know, that flower child, you know, drug culture then, the marijuana culture, people tend to misbehave a lot less in that culture than they do in the drunk culture.
Because it's passed out in the corner staring at a candle.
Exactly.
And, you know, you really don't get arrested.
Yeah,
but we were doing all kinds of stuff back then. You know, I mean, I'm 61 years old. We were getting high. We were dropping pills.
Really?
But we weren't destroying property. I don't recall any of that at all.
Yeah, and also, Greg, thank you for the call. A lot of states, including Rhode Island, I don't know what New Hampshire was at the time, but if Greg is still there, maybe you do. Was the drinking age 21 in New Hampshire then? Because I remember it was 18 in Rhode Island because of Vietnam.
I was still living in Ohio, but it was 21 in New Hampshire.
Okay.
It was 18 in New York. For many years.
Yeah, and in other states as well. So that made you able to go to college and go out drinking at a bar or drinking. You didn't have to do this binge drinking. That's one of the most horrible things I think about this whole segregation between the 18, 19, 20-year-olds who aren't allowed to legally drink
more.
And the seniors who are allowed to drink, is that your whole social scene at college is kind of turned into this warped thing where you're trying to hide the liquor from all the people that are the adults that could turn you in for drinking.
And by the way, for those who, when you heard Greg make the reference to Kent State, I assume everybody knows what he's talking about, a year before, I guess it was 1970, I think, four students were killed protesting by it was the Ohio National Garden, made famous by great
picture.
Neil Young song also.
And that
Ford
unbelievable
Dead in
picture
Ohio.
Of that young woman standing over this body. It was just horrible.
And by the way, you know, speaking of binge drinking, we've mentioned this 1,000 times in the years we've been on the radio. Forget people like us who have no expertise in the area. We've talked about the Amethyst Project, Amethyst
yes.
Initiative, which was founded by the former president. What's the name of that school in
Amherst?
No, it's not. It's called it's the guy from it begins with a W, I think. It's one of those colleges in north of us.
Oh.
In any case, but whatever the name of the
college.
No, I'll think of it in a minute. I don't think it's
it
in Massachusetts.
Amherst.
But in any case, someone could look up the Amethyst Initiative and what college did the guy run who was the founder of this thing. Essentially,
is it Middlebury?
Middlebury. It was Middlebury College. Thank you. Scores, if not hundreds, of college presidents signed on to this thing, lowering the drinking age to 18. These are college presidents.
Right.
Because they say, it's counterintuitive, but when you read their statement, it makes sense that the binge drinking is a function, great in part a function, of the fact that you're prohibited from drinking.
Yes.
The point you made about the distinction between the 21-year-old senior and the 18-year-old freshman or whatever it is. You should go. I don't know what the website is. I think it's amethystinitiative.org, but Google it and you'll find
and
it.
And one of the reasons it didn't get anywhere had to do with some federal reimbursements as well. That was one of the things that...
No, if you lower, you can lower your age now to drinking in your state to 18. My understanding is you lose all your federal highway funds,
exactly.
Which obviously nobody's going to do.
Okay. Leah from Providence, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Hi,
Hi, Leah.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent, thanks.
So I wanted to weigh in because I'm trained as a student affairs professional. We work with this particular age group of students, and we actually study this kind of behavior because it happens all over the place.
Okay,
so
great.
What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. The big majority of the people who participate in this kind of behavior are male, and we think that this has a lot to do with men and masculinity development of millennials. And I am a millennial, so I'm speaking from, you know, my own generation here. When you think about the way that young men have learned to demonstrate membership to masculinity, to male communities, to show that they're men and that they're growing, is that they destroy. Violent behaviors have been sort of the narrative for that. You look at video games, you look at computer games, you look at popular media that shows, you know, from a very early age that men are active and men destroy and, you know, they can, you know, create this kind of violence and destruction in their wake. And, you know, we also see out of that a lot of sexual violence on college campuses, but it manifests in a multitude of ways. And this is just one of them.
But before you go away, so is the reason it's most of these kinds of group things are not happening when they're 21 years old? Is that, and they're out of school, is that because that there's sort of this group mentality thing that one guy starts it and then all the other guys want to just join in? Is that what it is?
Precisely, because showing that you have membership to a male community doesn't mean anything unless you're doing it in front of other folks.
Got it.
And then
it.
You mentioned the social
got
media
it.
Component, right?
Yeah.
Now you're amplifying it. Yes, my friends saw I did it, and now my friends' friends are going to see that I did it, and we can all be in agreement that I am absolutely A-plus alpha male.
So what's the solution? Assuming your analysis is correct, Leah, what's the fix?
Oh, I'm glad that you asked that, because I'm a new mom, and I have two boys, and I just have been thinking about this a lot, and I think the solution that comes to my mind is providing a new narrative for masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we do that? How do we demonstrate membership? How do we provide young men opportunities to show that they are men? And how do we give them that opportunity without necessarily saying, here you go, like, you know, let's just give this to you? How do we help them invent a new narrative?
That's great,
I think
Leah.
That's just a pressing question I'd like to leave here.
Leah, you left it well. Thank you. Thank you so much. By the way, let's go to John Oliver for a second. Oliver, on his great show, talks about a federal program, Marjorie, that would help move unneeded military equipment to states and places like what we're talking about who want it.
It's enabled small towns like Keene, New Hampshire, to apply for a Bearcat, a military-grade armored personnel truck, which they needed because, as their application argued, the terrorism threat is far-reaching and often unforeseen, and cited as a possible target their annual pumpkin festival. Good luck easily outmaneuvering that, teenagers with baseball bats.
He's really funny. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Carolyn in Holden.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Yeah, I just it's obviously very concerning what went on, but I just wanted to say that I was there yesterday with my two kids, four and a year old, and my parents, and we had no idea that it was going on. We were there from 4 to 9 p.m. after dark, and we walked to our car in a parking lot, and everything seemed calm, and we enjoyed the festival, and I just had no idea till I got home. So that's
is that really so? I mean, so yeah. Are you in suggesting that maybe it was not quite as widespread as the media is reporting, or just that it was a different day in a different part of town?
I from what I understand, or the pictures that I see, it looks like it was at people's houses and on the campus, mm-hmm. and we were on Main Street where the Pumpkin Tower was. We walked through the food court. We went to our favorite store in Keene, the co-op, and we just, everyone was calm, and there were a lot of people there.
Did you call it the Pumpkin Tower? Is that what you called it?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a tower that they set up in the town square, the circle of pumpkins stacked up high, and lots of people taking pictures.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, Carolyn, we got an email from Christopher, one of our emailers in New Hampshire, who said that the thing that you were at might have been separate from the actual rioting that was going on.
That's what she's saying.
Yeah,
a different part of town.
In a different part of town.
Hey, Caroline, thank you for the call. Actually, there's another Keene State connection. John from Westboro. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just sent it to my car. I put you guys on the radio, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing, and I had to call.
Please.
Because I was there Saturday. My wife and I are both, we're in our mid-50s. We're both Keene State grads from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Our youngest son is presently a student there, which is one reason why we went up Saturday. We also had never been to the Pumpkin Festival, and it was just something to do on our to-do list. So we said, let's go. So we went. So if you give me a moment, I'd like to clarify a bunch of things.
Please do it.
The Keene Pumpkin Festival, I guess, has been going on for 24 years, and it's really gigantic, and they've done this thing where they made the Guinness Book of Records for the number of pumpkins that have been contributed. And then the Life is Good folks broke that record one year, if I'm not mistaken, on Boston Common, and it's gone back and forth. But the festival itself takes place in the downtown area in Main Street. They say it's the widest Main Street in the country. It's a beautiful downtown, and there's a big circle at the center of the town where the Congregation Church is, and there's a common there. And they set up staging, construction staging. It was about 8 or 9 levels high, and it's filled with pumpkins. And there must have been 20 or 25,000 people there on Saturday. From there, it's about a 10-minute walk down to the college. And we walked down there to meet our son. He was there. He was not involved in the rioting. My wife and I were shocked at what we saw. What was once a family neighborhood when we were there is now predominantly been turned over to rental housing for students. And there was about a 4-block area where it was just a mess and there were large parties. And let me tell you, I would be the first one to call out police for inappropriate behavior, but these guys were professional. We saw no inappropriate behavior by police, but we saw a strong police presence. We were wondering what that was, and only later we had learned earlier in the day there had been some violence and there had been some injuries. So I don't know if the police were there from the start. I guess stuff had happened on Friday night too. But my point is, it was about a 6 or 7 block difference from what went on at Keene State. It had nothing to do with the city's festival, which is a very good thing for merchants. And let me just say this really about Keene State. Somebody made a comment about Keene being a big drinking school.
Yeah, they did.
Keene is a party school, but it's really no different than your other party schools. And last comment, your previous caller, Lear, who was talking about male masculinity and male behavior, she was spot on. I saw that with my own eyes the other day. There was a small group. I would say 60% of the people who were there were on the edges and they were observing. And there was a nucleus of a smaller amount of people who were really acting out and causing all of the problems. And it was just really unfortunate. It was very discouraging as a Keene State alumni to see all that. But the confluence of social media, masculinity, acting out, all of that came together, and it was just really sad to see. And I give police credit for what they did, but they're separate.
Understood.
Yeah.
The festival. The festival was separate from what went on at the college. We were shocked to see it. And people up at the center of town would have no idea what was going on.
Well, like
down
that
at
woman.
The college.
Hey, John, thanks for your report from the scene. We really appreciate it.
You know, we should point out that there were several kudos to the police in these different stories. It said that when kids were throwing bottles at them and beer bottles at them and just being obnoxious, that the cops were just putting up with it and not overreacting. So a shout out to the police that went up to try to quell the activities up there in Keene. Okay, up next, TV's Bob Thompson joins us for his take on HBO and CBS doing standalone streaming. That blessed his best and worst TV moments of the week. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And here's Brookline's own Conan O'Brien weighing in on some big changes in the TV industry.
CBS is in the news. CBS will soon offer a paid subscription service. That means you can continue to watch CBS for free or you can pay for it. It's your call.
Here with us for his take on CBS and HBO's move to do standalone streaming is Bob Thompson. Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thanks.
We are great. So I think
Conan O'Brien's still on. I was kind of surprised at that.
Oh, he's a local boy, Bob. Don't knock him. We're rooting for him here in
kidding.
Boston.
He's one of my very favorites.
Oh, good. Well, he sort of put it perfectly on the CBS thing. We'll get to HBO in a second. But, you know, what gives? I mean, pay for it, continue to get it for free, or pay for it? I don't get it.
Well, that was a very funny joke, but it's really not the decision because, okay, you can get CBS for free if you have a television set and it's connected to a new digital converter and you're pulling those signals out of the air. And there are still some people who actually are doing that, a few more now than there were several years ago with increasing cable prices, but getting broadcast TV for free is something very few people do. Most of them are getting it over a satellite or a cable box, and that is by no means for free. So the decision now is whether you're going to not get CBS for free or pay for it. It's whether you're going to get CBS as part of the package you pay for on cable or satellite, or whether you're going to get CBS by paying a completely separate $5.99 per month fee to watch it through your computer, which you can then put over to your television set if you've got the proper technology.
Well, you know, speaking about CBS,
that wasn't as funny as how Conan described it.
No, you ruined the joke.
Yeah, CBS and HBO both, Bob. So they're doing this thing. It seems to me the consequences are one of two. Either it's the beginning of the end of cable, or at minimum, it's what we've all been praying for, the end of bundling and more a la carte cable. Is either of those going to happen?
Well, I think both of those tendencies we're moving toward. But let's remember how long this kind of thing generally takes. I mean, this might not be an apt comparison, but I think of the transition from the last old to new medium media, which was from radio to television. And it took a long time for that to occur. Matter of fact, there were a lot of radio shows that were simulcast on television for people who were, you know, for both audiences in that transition. And it was probably 10 years before television had completely taken over from radio as the medium that did sitcoms and cop shows and sci-fi and all of that kind of thing. The transition from black and white to color took a little over a decade before it happened. We're in that transition now. I think there are still, I mean, I know there are still most people out there who are watching television the old-fashioned way, on a television set with a signal that's coming in to their house either through cable or satellite. And there are going to be a lot of people who are going to continue to watch that way for some time. But I think first HBO and then the very next day CBS made announcements that indicate that they're setting up the infrastructure for that transition. We've talked many times before about how so many people, especially young people, especially my students, don't even have television.
Exactly.
And all these places want to make sure they can accommodate those audiences. They don't lose those audiences. And my guess is the numbers, the proportional numbers are going to shift. Now, most HBO audiences are still going to be watching HBO over their cable. But I think that potential audience that they're going to reach with this new standalone system is going to grow higher and higher and higher, so that somewhere down the line, probably most of the television we watch is going to be done over some kind of system that occurs online.
But let me ask you a stupid question, because I'm not 25. When you know, these kids, and my kids do the same thing, they watch everything on their computers, but you can already, right, hook up that computer to a correctly equipped television set and watch on your TV.
Right. There are lots of, and relatively easy, Chromecast is one of them, where you can make your television, or you can make your computer, your laptop, your tablet, whatever, send it over to your television set, which pretty soon most people are going to be able to do, because once you're using your computer to get programming, which in some cases is the only way we can get things like Netflix, for example,
exactly,
people are going to want the option to take that programming that only their computer supplies and watch it on their fancy new 95-inch Toshiba 3D, you know, super high-definition televisions. Some people can do that already. It's a relatively easy process as long as you've got a new enough TV. But there are those who can't. And let's remember, tens of millions of TV viewers are still watching TV without any of that stuff.
You know, Bob, you mentioned a minute ago black and white, the color, and you mentioned radio transitioning into TV. Whatever happened to radio? No, that's okay. Forget that.
Well, I mean, that's an interest. That's actually a really pertinent question.
It is?
Because radio did not go away.
It did.
Radio continues to be relevant. Radio continues to make lots and lots of money for lots and lots of people. What happened was television took over as the dominant entertainment medium with regards to this multi-genre. They're the ones that do comedies and reality shows and all the stuff that radio had done. And then radio found a way to for its own niche, which is primarily talk, which is what we're doing now, sports, and music. And, of course, rock and roll came along just at the right time as television was totally challenging radio's old content base. Rock and roll music came along and gave them something to do that television was not nearly as set up to do.
Two very quick things to wrap this up. Number one, do we have any idea what this is going to cost or no?
The CBS we do, the HBO we don't. CBS, I think, said $5.99 a month.
Okay.
HBO, I have no idea. But my guess is it's going to be comparable to an HBO subscription. I can't imagine that they would
undercut itself.
Themselves, exactly. If all of a sudden they charge half the price to get it online, they're going to lose their own people. And their business model on cable has been very, very successful. And they don't want to upset their cable operators, who help HBO in a whole number of different ways.
And one last thing here, in terms of business model, it seems I am stunned that none of the cable providers have decided to take a chance and allow you to unbundle everything and do a la carte. I mean, assuming you're in a community that has choice, and a lot of them don't, wouldn't everybody switch to that in about 2.5 seconds, or do they not do it because all the competitors would do the same thing?
People would switch. I mean, if you had the chance tomorrow to only pay for what you get, that's exactly what you'd do. However, be careful what you wish for, because all of these cable channels are in a way being subsidized by all of the really popular ones. And everybody's got their own little favorite obscure cable channel, the golf games of the 80s cable channel and the whatever cable channel.
Love
and
that.
The only reason a lot of cable channels survive is because they're bundled. If we go to the a la carte system, every cable channel has to compete in the same marketplace ratings kind of system, almost like every television show competes. And a lot of people would find that their favorite cable channel would go off the if we went to a la carte, we might find that 5 years after we went to a la carte, there were 12 really, really popular cable channels offered, and the rest of them had gone away.
Oh, if we're going to lose golf games of the 80s, well, forget about it.
Yeah, one of my kids watches this pawn shop show. It's absolutely horrible. It's about people fighting over selling things in this creepy pawn shop. Do you have any idea what station that's
that
on? If that station went away, I'd be...
There's lot of pawn... There's Pawn Stars. There's four or five pawn shop things on, and it's a terribly popular subgenre.
I guess.
And I suppose in many ways this comes out of the PBS show Antiques Roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of turning people's junk into compelling television. And if you give some of those pawn shop shows a chance, they actually can sometimes really suck you in.
Oh, no kidding. They suck you in. But let's move on to something else that apparently is sucking people in. I didn't even know this existed until I was on the Massachusetts Turnpike getting gas. And all of a sudden, I look up and there's TV. There's a TV set, or at least a screen, right next to me. Gas station TV, reaching 50 million people. What do we make of this, Bob? Thompson.
Well, I don't know why this didn't happen a long, long time ago. And it did. Back in I think it was the 80s, there was a couple of oil companies who had started putting video screens right into their pumps. But there are two places where you have got people's rapt attention and they can't go away. One of them is the gas station, and we'll talk about it in a second. The other is in the bathroom stall or on the wall on top of a urinal.
Oh, great.
And I am amazed how we have not seen that kind of use of advertising in those places where people can't move. You take, since the 1980s, with these big SUVs and stuff, for some people, filling up the gas tank can take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can't go anywhere. You're connected to a hose filled with flammable material. In most states, you're not allowed to let the thing fill itself while you go off and do other things. So you've got that captive audience. The idea of installing, and it's going to be modular kind of airline-style programming where you've got a loop of probably stuff picked from other networks, which you've made agreements with, and then you sell advertisement to that. It's a great idea.
By the way, Sam, you mentioned the urinal.
And if gas station TV is here now, bathroom stall TV should not be far behind. I'm sure it exists somewhere that I just don't know.
Well, also, 10 minutes of the gas pump, you can spend 10 minutes of the urinal, as we all well know. I have not. Is this happened, or is this? I have not seen. I've seen newspapers hung on a wall above
the
urinal.
Has the 10 minutes of the urinal happened? Yes. At a 55-year-old,
okay,
I can tell
fine.
You that.
Forget that whole thing. Hey, Bob, let's move to something. I had a painful experience. On Sunday, I watched a tape of Saturday Night Live hosted by Sarah Silverman. I'm a Sarah Silverman fan. That was one of the least funny 60 minutes. Is it 60 minutes? I guess. Whatever. 90, whatever it is. About 90. As unfunny as I have ever seen Saturday Night Live. She wasn't that good. The cast, in my opinion, with the exception of Kenan Thompson, who I think is a genius, was atrocious. And then I read this morning that Bill Hader, who's one of the great alum, comes back to host. I missed that one. And it tied for the lowest SNL rating ever. Are we seeing the beginning of the end of SNL, or is this just a dip in the action?
Well, we've seen the beginning of the end of SNL many, many times since 1975. So I suppose we shouldn't draw too many conclusions yet. That show has had its highs and it's had some really bad lows. And you can go back and people have predicted the end of that for a long time, yet it's been going for, 40 years now. So... but it did. You're right. It the Bill Hader episode last week tied for the lowest rated episode of all time. Now, in some cases, ratings are going down for everything, but this is a slide that's kind of disturbing. I think there's a couple of things going on. Number one, a lot of people just aren't watching Saturday Night Live anymore, which is kind of paradoxical when you think about it. One of the appeals of the show when it started was that it was done live. And now most people are waiting to watch the clips of what gets deemed funny by the next day. So Saturday Night Live is still culturally relevant, but more after it's been sliced and diced and put online.
I love to watch the clips at the urinal, by the way. That's where I most enjoy SNL clips.
It would be perfect for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Saturday Night Live is excellent for gas station TV. A sketch is about it, how long it takes to fill up your Subaru Outback.
Sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
But anyway, there's also, though, some of their really talented people who have made, I think, the last several years, some very rich years for Saturday Night Live, have left recently. Yeah. They've lost Andy Samberg, Fred Armisen, Jason Sudeikis, Seth Meyers, and Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader, who you'd have thought might have boosted ratings because they came back and they did some funny things last week, but that doesn't seem to have happened. So we'll have to wait and see. It's for Saturday Night Live to count it down before you get all the way to 10 is always a mistake.
Could be a building season, right? They need to build up and get the great people back.
Yeah, and that's happened before, too. And you're right. There's a few people there who look like they could potentially, really blossom into, somebody we all know who they are a year or two from now. But they are in a lot of the people on that cast now are freshmen.
Well, I guess we don't like much the comedy we're seeing now on SNL, but there's something else we apparently love, which is Zombie Apocalypse, this Walking Dead show, which sounds absolutely terrible, is shattering all these cable records. We got a clip from the season 5 trailer for The Walking Dead. Here it is.
They're screwing with the wrong people. I just hope you understand that we didn't want to hurt you. Oh. Nothing was personal.
You don't have to do this. We can put the world back to how it was. We have a man. He has a cure. We just have to get him to Washington. You just have to take a chance.
Well, it sounds really wonderful to me, Bob Thompson, but apparently it's
That does sound horrible over radio.
It certainly does, but apparently this show is through the roof. I guess there's a lot of this kind of creepiness that's through the roof on television, but what's the big deal about The Walking Dead? Why is it so popular?
There is. Well, first of all, I mean, there's a lot of interest in zombies and vampires and all the rest of it, and, some people say, it's because... for somebody who has lost their job back in 2008, and every time they turn on the TV, people are talking about Ebola and Congress can't get anything done. I think many people see these kind of apocalyptic shows as documentaries describing a life not dissimilar to the one they're observing. But I don't buy the idea that Walking Dead is getting all these great ratings for some sociological reason why zombies are relevant in today's apocalyptic society. I think it's getting really high ratings because even though it's not my cup of tea, it is an extraordinarily good program. Writing based as a lot of the shows that we've been talking about, but it's got a action that doesn't stop, interesting characters in an odd sort of way, an almost optimistic quality. I mean, there is some hope as these people, the survivors are going around. But we should talk for a second about how extraordinarily successful this is. It debuted in the fifth season at 17.3 million viewers. And then when they added the plus 3 days of who watched on DVR, it went to 22 million.
Wow. Okay, hold on for a second. Hold on for a second. And you should point out that the first season, the premiere, involved getting hooked up with some cannibals, which is always fun. But go ahead. Cannibals.
Yeah, cannibalism has worked in American entertainment for some time. We could do a whole show on that. Anyway,
so you're about
17.3 million people, up to 22 million people. Just to put some perspective onto that, The Big Bang Theory, which is one of the, still big hits on, one of the biggest hits on broadcast TV, that same week got about 15 million. Walking Dead, among the 18 to 49, that demographic everybody talks about so much, actually beat NBC Sunday Night Football by 2.5 million viewers in 18 to 49. So this is a show that's not only breaking all cable records everywhere it goes, it's a program that is beating just about everything, sometimes everything, on network TV. So basic cable now is... got the potential to reach total parity and above with network TV, and that hasn't been the case for very long.
You know, by the way, when I saw on our list of things to talk to you about The Walking Dead, I thought that was the new title of SNL, but apparently I was wrong.
Oh, boy. That
is horrible. Thank you. Conan O'Brien's right down the street. Okay, it's that time, Bob Thompson. This is our favorite thing. We started about a month ago with this. Every week you give us the best and worst of the TV week. So let's start with the best. What is it?
Well, I think the best this week is a CW show, and you're not going to get me to call a CW show the best very often, probably, but this time I think it deserves it. It's got the unlikely title of Jane the Virgin, and it's got the further unlikely premise of a young chaste woman who has never had sex, who gets accidentally artificially inseminated on her trip to the to her doctor. But if you can get over all the ridiculousness of the title and the premise, it's really a fascinating, charming, interesting program. One of my favorite new shows of the season.
Bob, we've got some sound from Jane the Virgin. In this scene, Jane is at the emergency room waiting to find out why she's fainting and getting sick to her stomach. Here it is.
Nausea and fainting spell solved. You're pregnant.
I'm sorry, but she's just not
pregnant. No, I'm not pregnant.
We tested your urine.
Trust me, the test is wrong.
False negatives are frequent. False positives are rare.
Jane, did you wear Michael?
No, we didn't. And it may be rare, but it happened. Because I'm a virgin.
A virgin? Maybe we should talk in private.
No. No, we don't need to talk in private.
I think we do.
Where did you get your degree from? The University of Dumbass? My daughter said that she is a freaking virgin, so do another damn test.
And by the way, the sperm that
artificial... I got my associate's degree from there. I resent that.
The sperm is the sperm of her boss, correct?
Yes, but it gets further than that. Not only her rich boss, who is a cancer survivor, so he's got no more sperm, but also that it was the first kiss she ever had when he was a little kid was with him. So when the two of them were little kids. And not only that, her real father is this spectacularly famous telenovela star. So the depth of just funny, quirky kinds of stuff. You remember a show called Pushing Daisies or Chuck?
No.
Those two shows kind of remind me of the sort of charming ridiculousness that this show manages to accomplish.
I mean, and from what I've read of this, and all the reviews I've read have been spectacular, you just have to totally suspend belief about anything and just sit there and laugh, yes?
Yeah, you let it go. It's based on a Venezuelan telenovela, and it's very much got a lot of the aesthetics of the telenovela in it. She watches them, and her mother watches them, and all the rest of it.
It's also got a
lot of Spanish speaking. There's actually some subtitles in it. It's a different kind of thing. I think it's lots of fun.
Tell people what a telenovela is, Bob, please.
Oh, well, most of the Spanish-speaking world, which is a large part of the world, have had what, similar to what we know of daytime soap operas, they have in prime time, five nights a week, ongoing stories, but they tend to end after a finite period of time, as opposed to our soap operas, which can go on for 72 years. We've never been able to make the five-day-a-week soap opera work on prime time. We've tried it a couple of times when that new network sprung out of the wreckage of the WB-UPN merger, but it's never worked in this country. So what happens is we occasionally take these very successful five-day-a-week telenovelas that play in other countries, and we turn them into primetime shows, and we only show them once a week and change them, and this is one of them.
Okay, so what is the worst moment of the week, Bob?
Well, I have to give my worst to the Nielsen Ratings Service, which managed to have a software glitch that I guess has been messing up broadcast ratings since as far back as March, including, I think we talked last week about how ABC had taken over from NBC and the nightly news for the first time since 2007, and wasn't this a big watershed? Well, it turns out ABC didn't take over from NBC. Nielsen announced the glitch. NBC is still number one, I think, 265 weeks in a row. So the cake that Mrs. Muir bought for David Muir, I suppose, has already been eaten.
I know,
but
poor
it was
David.
Celebrating a victory that didn't occur.
You know, before we let you go, we are told by our lead producer, Chelsea Mers, that you have actually a true confession to make before you leave today. What might that be?
I thought we'd get away from this.
What is this?
Well, we've been doing this now for what? These best and worst for
about
several weeks. And
yeah.
I think I've given a worst to Manhattan Love Story, Selfie, A to Z. And I do have to confess that I've been finding over the past couple of weeks that the shows that I say good things about, Gotham and whatever, are stacking up in my DVR. Yet I am completely up and have watched every episode of all three of those shows I gave worst to. So maybe I've got to rethink the notion of what worst is. I don't like them, but I keep going back to them. So they're doing something really good, and I guess, therefore, they shouldn't be called. If I'm more excited to watch Selfie on my DVR than I am to watch the latest episode of Homeland, doesn't mean that Selfie is better than Homeland. It isn't. Homeland is better. But it means that Selfie is doing what television in the age of the Love Boat used to be really good at, which is giving us something to watch when we're half asleep.
Exactly.
I live my life that way.
That's
Amen.
How I feel about the pawn shop shows. I can't believe how I'm sucked into
these.
There
you go.
Pawn...
You're an honest man, Bob Thompson.
I'm going to think twice before I give these shows worst ratings
okay.
again.
Bob Thompson,
to talk to you. Thank you very much for being
you
with
too.
Us.
You too.
Bob is the founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Coming up, how will the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price score Pope Francis this week in the aftermath of the big synod on homosexuality and divorce? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brattis. She is Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 is there every Monday for All Revved Up, our Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. And we're going to go back in time with a reminder of where each of them were on the Catholic Church last week. Here I am reading them a news report. Gays had gifts to offer the church and should be accepted, and that there were, quote, positive aspects to a couple living together without being married.
Last week, on a scale of 5, I gave our Pope a 2.
Okay.
I give him a 2.25.
This is huge!
Huge. That was Emmett Price. In any case, Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is called The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. What a difference a week makes. Hello to both of you.
Hey, thanks
hey,
for having
good
us back.
To be here.
Thanks.
Okay, so the wind is a little bit out of our sails. Those of us who are hoping they're going to be great things for the LGBT community and the church, as well as divorced and remarried Catholics. What's your take, Irene?
Well, that's why I gave him a robust
2.25.
And now I rescind.
Quarter?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Okay. Just as the church backpedaled on the issue. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this is the problem. The church has a crisis not only of faith, but of identity as well as integrity. You know, interestingly enough, when they first came out last week, we were quite excited about it. They had a statement that says welcoming homosexual persons that after a while changed the language and became less welcoming by saying providing for homosexual persons. They changed partners to these people. So I'm quite disappointed.
Yeah, I'm disappointed too, but not as disappointed as you are probably or Jim is, but I'll tell you why in a minute.
Well let's hear from Emmett.
We'll hear from Emmett first. What do you think, Emmett?
I am still a believer in the Pope.
Oh,
now the church I'm upset with.
You
right?
my guy.
And see, here's the thing. I love the fact that the Pope said, if you're going to vote, we want to know how you voted. And he publicized the vote. That's huge. Now, for the church, I mean, this is the analogy of the baked cake, right? So you bake a cake, you make the batter, and they usually taste the batter. And unfortunately, there's a little too much sugar in the batter, so they went back and they changed the recipe before they put it in the oven and baked it. So the final outcome of the cake...
I will never eat your cake. just absolutely know that. Absolutely know that.
Now, I don't do that, Irene, but I'm just saying what happened.
No, can I tell you what the problem is? The guy who captured it, in my estimation, is Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle. I hope that's pronounced right, from the Philippines. Here's his quote. Some people might sense that the welcoming, the space that's been opened, meaning the original, the preliminary report, was suddenly closed. That is not the case. Openness remains. Had we not read the what we read in the middle, which apparently did not represent either a majority or two-thirds, I guess they need two-thirds for formal embrace of these positions. If we had not read what we read a week ago, Irene Munro, would you be as disappointed today as you are? You wouldn't, right?
I'm disappointed anyway about the Catholic Church. I mean, because I think one of the things we think is because the Pope has a sort of conciliatory, you know, tone, that he's going to bring about policy. This is two problems I have. One is sort of this sort of incongruity of a cohort of celibate men discussing the place of birth control, rearing children, and marital relationships for non-celibate Catholics. That's one of the problems. Then this whole notion of the traditional family. What is the traditional family? They say they want to roll back to the traditional family. Well, the traditional family looks like this. It's Mary, Jesus, and Joseph. Mm-hmm. Now, truth be told, that configuration is suspect. We call it in seminary a hermeneutic of suspicion. Mm-hmm. Mary, okay, was supposed, well, she's supposedly a virgin, but if we look at what that meant, it meant a young woman. Joseph is not Jesus's biological family.
Yeah, very irregular.
Okay. So the point is that that is the American family. That is the traditional family. So they have what, as I said before, not only a crisis of faith, but identity and integrity. And they negate the whole idea of what Catholic means. Catholicity means universal, means inclusion. So they have just reneged on their social gospel.
Marjorie, why don't you give your prediction that you gave me earlier this morning about what's going to happen next year?
A couple of things. Number one, it's an international church, and mm-hmm. in a lot of these countries, it's illegal to be gay. You can still be arrested. So you have these cardinals from these very backward places that are in there. That's number one. Number two, the Pope can do whatever the heck he wants at the end of the Second Synod.
When is that? Next year?
Yes, that's in 2015. He can do whatever he wants. And he talked about hostile rigidity. And he was talking about people that have these attitudes about gays and lesbians, et cetera. And
people
about,
meaning cardinals?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes. So I'm with Emin over here. If he survives and he doesn't die, I mean, he's not that old, but he's old. He's in his late 70s, and no one knocks him off because they're so upset about his views. I'm hoping that at the end of 2015, he'll be like John the 23rd and say, the heck with you all. This is where we're going.
Yeah. Okay, but you know what? He needs to really make a robust sort of affirmation of LGBT people or those of us on the margin. So let me give you an example. So he says here, a quote from him, he says, the church can neither throw stones at sinners, nor be too accommodating to a worldly spirit. So I find that as a theological qualifier. You know, the whole notion of hate the sin, but hate the sinner. So and so that, again, needs some working. Either he's being duplicitous, or he's trying to walk a very fine line and is not being successful.
Or he is politically trying to bring these people along so that he doesn't have to totally do a 180 on what they ultimately vote next year, which is what you and Marjorie think.
He has the bridge. He has the bridge. So he had to open up the conversation. He took the pulse of the International Catholic Church by leaking out that 1 week synopsis of what the conversation was. You know, it didn't go that way, but now everything is on the table. We have a whole nother year until about October 2015 for some more conversation.
Oh, so you're going to keep hope alive, I assume.
Well, one last thing. Not that I wish anyone's untimely death, but a lot of these cardinals are very old. They age out at like 80. Most of them have been appointed by real rabid conservatives, Benedict and John Paul II. So my hope is that a few of them will be they'll be gone. He'll be able to appoint a few more of his own guys, and the people he's appointed have been much more liberal.
Oh, you are just
and some may be demoted.
Can you tell me one of these guys?
Absolutely,
that guy Burke, Cardinal Burke.
And what did Cardinal Burke do?
He was one of the most vehement, saying, you know, talking about, you know, homosexual acts is disordered and always wrong and always evil. He got the shove out. He was in charge, like the equivalent of the
Supreme
Court.
This past week,
over
he got the shove out.
Yes, and now he's got some little inconsequential job someplace.
He's probably
else,
gay himself.
Can I tell you? Well, it's possible. Can I tell you something?
Well, a lot of them. problem.
I was very much closer to you, Irene, this morning when I got here. But after having listened to Marjorie a little bit, and you who raised this transparency point, Charlie Sennett was with us earlier this morning, and he was quoting John Ireland, your colleague,
CruxNow.com,
talking about the transparency thing. And it seems to me that what I'm reading into it, that what Pope Francis's agenda is, let the light shine
in. That's right.
And then it's going to create more pressure on these, I was going to say men and women, on these men.
Yeah, no women.
To do the right thing by whatever date you said, October of 2015.
Can't go that
by the way, everybody's got to be disappointed by the flip. But the issue is, what does it bode for the future?
Right.
You think,
a schism in the Catholic Church, I think that's what it's going to bode. I mean, when you look at the bishop in New York, I can't think of
Dolan,
okay, charismatic as can be, darling, but as conservative as can be. He doesn't want to bring change. And so that's the thing, because they're very set on that while we all live in sin, we're constantly live in sin, and the only way that we can really sort of make amends for the way we live in sin is to adhere to the edicts of the Catholic Church.
There's an old saying that the they today may not be the they tomorrow.
Well, the point is
ooh, I like that,
Emmett. I like that. Okay. But the point is, you're thinking that these people are going to die. Well, it would have to be a tsunami of death, really, in order for it to really have a sea change.
You don't think the demotion of this
25 or 30.
You don't think the demotion of this Cardinal Burke that Marjorie and Emmett are talking about sends a message?
It says that you can have these thoughts, and we will probably implement these thoughts. You just need to be on the down low about it.
How do you think, while he released the roll call, as you were mentioning, mm-hmm. Emmett, mm-hmm. and what the vote total was and what the language was, obviously, we don't know. This is not like a Senate vote where you get to find out the Cardinal so-and-so voted this way. How do you think Cardinal O'Malley voted on all this stuff? And by the way, the moderate positions, let me just say, the moderate positions, the modified positions on gay marriage, on gays, and on divorced people, while they were moderated, they didn't get the 2/3. And a lot of people think they didn't get the 2/3 because the progressives, who are really angry with the watering down of the language, voted no on the more moderate language. So it didn't get the 2/3 actually as a protest vote, which I find, if it's true, to be fairly comforting. How do you think O'Malley voted on this?
I have no idea, but I hope he voted on the moderate side, the Pope side.
You don't mean moderate.
Side.
You mean the progressive
side. Progressive side.
Yes. Yeah. But I could be wrong, but they're fairly close. And I would think that's part of the reason that they're fairly close is they share a similar worldview on some of these things, I hope. Mm-hmm.
So are we down to 1.75 on a scale of – where are we? I just want to know for next week's developments. Where are we exactly?
And trying to keep hope alive, and I'm very
much trying to.
Thank you. Okay, it has slipped to a 2.
A 2. Oh, only to a 2.
Slipped back to a
bad.
Slope.
That's hope.
Well, that is for Irene. Beautiful.
That's great.
We could be at a minus, talking here. So let's move on to this story about Darren Wilson. Everyone knows the terrible story out of Ferguson, Missouri, where Michael Brown was killed, an unarmed young man, by this police officer, Darren Wilson. And now he has an account saying that he was afraid. By the way, it is different from the account of the friend of Michael Brown. But in any case, he's given this account that he was feared for his life, that after he stopped.
Darren Wilson did.
The cop feared for his life. That's right. That he was trying to leave his car after he stopped Brown and his friend when Brown pushed him back in. Once inside the car, the two began to fight. Wilson says he removed his gun in the holster. Wilson said Brown punched and scratched him repeatedly, leaving swelling on his face and cuts. This, again, contradicts with what the friend who was there said. And according to the cop, Brown never tried to grab, according to the friend, rather, Brown never tried to grab Wilson's gun. It doesn't change what happened outside the car, which is still that he shot 4 more bullets at Brown outside the car. But what do you make of this? Does this change anything in terms of the investigation or the public outrage here?
Yeah, I mean, it changes the fact that the grand jury has still been going at this. They have an extension until January 7th, and that's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And I understand that they're a part-time grand jury, that they really only meet maybe once a month, maybe for 4 to 6 or 7 hours. But there's enough information to suggest that something happened and that they can allow this to go to trial. Robert McCullough, who's the prosecuting attorney, has these issues in terms of if they go too soon without all the information, then he could be exonerated or whatnot. But I think they need to indict him, go to trial and move forward. What we do know is that two shots were fired in the car.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we do know that Michael Brown was hit in the car. And there's blood in the arm. And there was blood on the door. Then we know that
Michael
Brown's blood. Then we do know that he was released somehow from the car and got a distance away.
And then was shot at
four additional times where he was murdered. So I think there's enough information to create this suspicion of what happened. And now that we know that Darren Wilson was afraid of his life, afraid for his life, we do know that his own emotional situation was not stable, being a law officer, particularly since Michael Brown was away from him when those final shots were shot.
Well, may I ask you a question here? Maybe I missed this. But if this police officer was punched and scratched repeatedly, leaving swelling on his face and cuts on his neck,
okay.
Have we had verification of that or pictures of the police officer taken at the back at the station house that would show
no,
that?
Doesn't that seem odd? With George Zimmerman, if you recall, he did say that he was fighting for his life, and indeed there was some evidence of it. It still doesn't certainly exonerate the excessive force that was used.
Yeah.
You know, the very interesting thing is I do believe that Darren Wilson was fearful, because one of the things that we don't address is that white cops and have a fear of black men. And so I really wanted to know what exactly, you know, how was that calibrated? Because, you know, other than that, you're hearing stories. So, of course, you know, Jim and Marjorie and Emmett, too. I had to go find another survey, right? So according to a range of surveys and that look at implicit associations around implicit bias and what have you, that white Americans are more afraid of black men than any group in the country. And they found that that in a survey in 2009, when they asked the question about violence and blacks, that an overwhelming 90% say that the face of that, the nexus of that too, is indeed a black male.
Do you know who also said once, and I'm going to paraphrase, that if he turned around and was followed by a bunch of black kids, he'd be more scared than if he's followed by a bunch of white Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that changed briefly right after 9/11. When people were briefly more afraid of groups of young Muslim men. We did a funny story about that.
No, I don't think so, because one of the things that we forget, though, is that blacks are also Muslims. And how we get the religion, mm-hmm. Islam, comes through the slave trade.
Yeah.
And so when Obama, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
You're not
I've done
the first.
It a million times. Osama Obama.
Okay.
We know who you're talking about. By the way, I want you to know, Emmett Price is so disgusted with what you're saying, Irene. He's already packed up his stuff and apparently is ready to go. I don't blame you.
I usually pack up
Can
fast.
I tell you, when I heard the initial reports, virtually everybody, including reporters who are trying to play it down the middle, and I would say CNN generally does, are saying that this report's broken by the New York Times, by the way, helps the case of the Darren Wilson side of things. And even if you subscribe to that, I think your point was perfect, Emmett. There is enough dispute about the facts. Send it to trial.
Yeah,
there is clearly enough credible evidence from the Dorian Johnsons of the world, who was his friend, mm-hmm. who was there, mm-hmm. other witnesses who suggest the kid, Michael Brown, did nothing.
Yeah.
Obviously, apparently, Wilson's going to testify otherwise. Mm-hmm. That's why you have juries to distinguish between two different set of facts. Can I ask one more thing before you speak? And this is to you, Marjorie, as a journalist. Are you stunned? How many months ago did this happen, by the way? Do we know exactly?
It was in August, wasn't
August
it?
9th.
Okay, August 9th, September, October. It is a couple of months and a half.
Yeah.
Are you stunned that no reporter has found Darren Wilson in 2.5 months? We know he allegedly left Ferguson, but no reporter has even knocked on a door which Wilson is behind. That is staggering to me.
I agree.
Isn't
it? Absolutely.
I don't mean they're not trying.
They may have.
What? And because we're national security, they're not disclosing that they found
him? Well, if he doesn't talk to you, you don't.
Well, you know what? They'd have those horrible television
things
where the reporter's shown knocking on the door and someone behind the door says, "I'm sorry, we're not answering." Irene, I interrupted you.
No,
I'm sorry.
That's fine. What I wanted to just say is that what's very, very interesting is that Darren Wilson felt very frightened of these two boys, and which is very interesting. And just this weekend was a pumpkin fest that got rowdy as can be.
Yeah,
and anybody know anything about Keene, New Hampshire? It is predominantly white.
New Hampshire.
Well, that too. Okay? but the interesting thing is that rowdiness did not end with anybody's child being killed. So that's,
you know what, though? I thought you were going to say, can you imagine if that had been a bunch of young black men and women?
Oh,
can you imagine?
That just would have been crazy.
It would have been. It would have been. We would have hauled in the Marines. Would have been up there. I didn't even think of that when we were talking about
that's
it.
That's a wonderful point. You know, before you go, since we're trying to end occasional segments on an upbeat note, which we almost never do anymore, no matter who we're talking about. This Bishop Thomas Shaw, former Episcopal leader here, died at 69. I never met him, but I have never read a negative word. In fact, I've never read anything except positive. What's the word on this guy, Emmett, particularly in the religious community?
Sure. I mean, for anybody who would go down to Washington, D.C. and be a legislative intern, I mean, for this person of high, you know, ecclesiological, you know, standing is just awesome. I mean, very quiet spoken.
Humble.
Very humble. Very, very spiritual is the term that many people. I was in the room with him one time where we were talking about youth violence issues. I believe it was in the South End where the meeting was. And this gentleman sat there with his characteristic black robe and didn't say anything the whole time. But you knew that his presence was there and you knew people kept deferring to him. So it was almost as if he had people in the room who would speak for him, even though he didn't have to say anything.
He walked the walk. He didn't just talk it, which was really wonderful. I remember he had a profound impact in shaping my public ministry as a minister. Absolutely.
How so?
And I'll always remember this quote. He says that our public life is very much part of our religious journey. And he really sort of deflates this sort of dichotomy we have between the sacred and profane, you know, that there's a fluidness. Mm-hmm. And he walked with that sort of fluidity through life and stuff. And he did a lot around gang violence, really nurturing black males, also helping folks, you know, folks who want to come, LGBT folks.
Well, here's this quote. Listen to this quote.
Through the Episcopal Church.
And remember, this is quite a while ago. This is not like a week ago. Kind of the key advocate, according to the Globe Obituary, which is great, by the way, for gay rights, for the ordination of women, gays, and lesbians. It was written by Brian Markhard in the Globe. Listen to this great quote. The life of the church is always enhanced by including people that live on the margins of society. Women,
right.
People of color, gay or lesbian people. They have something profound to say about the kingdom of God, and they are the people Jesus specifically included amongst his disciples.
See, that's an amen moment.
How powerful.
That's right.
Is that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Living a sort of liberation theology that was inclusive of all, that shows the Catholicity of what a church should do.
Well, you know, I think to get back to the Pope, and that's with the Pope, I mean, when he talked about them being, and this means the cardinals, obsessed with things about gender and sex, he was absolutely right.
Yeah.
If they were saying you got to pick up the pace on taking care of the poor, would anybody be hysterical angry?
No issue.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's not surprising, a bunch of guys living alone, isolated from the world.
Supposedly celibate men.
Supposedly celibate men.
Talking about a non-celibate population.
Yeah. And
about
women,
family. And, right.
And sex.
And you still keep hope alive on this?
Jim, we had a high note for a second.
We did, actually.
Okay. All right.
At that note, thank you.
All right.
It's great to see you both, as always.
I try to be optimistic. You know, I try to be optimistic. Okay. The Reverend Irene Monroe gave the Pope. Would you give him a 2.2 or something?
A 2.0.
No,
2.0.
Okay. All right.
He's gone down on my scale.
He's gone down.
We're not going to ask her what she gave the Synod, by the way. That we don't even want to hear that.
Okay.
See
thank you both.
Both
for being here, as always. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thanks again, you guys, for coming in. Up next, we continue our series of ballot question explainers. Question number 4, Paid Sick Days Initiative. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. We are continuing our series of ballot question explainers with a focus on question 4. It's the Paid Sick Day Initiative. If approved by the voters, the measure would allow certain employees throughout the state to earn and use paid sick days. Of course, that's a huge generalization of the proposed law. We'll have the combatants, for lack of a better expression, explain it. Here with us in Studio 3 to debate the nitty-gritty details of this initiative are Steve Crawford and Bob Luz. Steve is a spokesperson for Raise Up Massachusetts and the Yes on Four campaign. Bob Luz is president of the Southborough-based Massachusetts Restaurant Association. He is against the sick day initiative, wants you to vote no. Bob, Steve, great to see you both.
Great to see you. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Steve. Just explain what this ballot question says.
No opinion. We'll get to the opinion in a minute.
It is question four on the ballot. It would allow every worker in Massachusetts to earn 1 hour of sick time for every 30 hours that they work for a maximum of 40 hours. This is for full and part-time employees. If you work at a business that has 10 or fewer employees, it is unpaid sick time. If you work at a place that has more than 10 employees, it is paid sick time.
Is that a fair description, Bob?
It's very fair. It's a very fair description.
And just so we're clear, before you start both you saying why it's a good idea, Steve, why you believe it's a bad idea, Bob, under existing law in Massachusetts, because I have to say Marjorie and I were not aware of this when we started talking about it, if someone works at a place where there is no paid sick leave or no unpaid sick leave and they have to take a day off, they just take a day off and they don't get paid, or they're not, or you're shaking your head, yes, Steve Crawford? Is that yes?
Yes.
And if it turns out Bob, that's not true?
Not necessarily true.
Well, explain how it's not.
Well, because there's plenty of employers that, even though it's not mandated, there's a lot of employers out there that offer these benefits.
Oh, I understand.
Certainly
that.
Do right. full-time
No,
benefits.
I understand. But if you don't offer the benefit.
Correct.
And if you don't offer the benefit, you can either take the day if your employer allows it or not take the day because you don't want to lose the dough. Is that?
Yeah. And what normally happens a lot, Jim, Marjorie, is it's shift. It's called shift swapping, and it's gone on forever. The industries that I'm here talking about really largely are the service industry. So there's retail, hospitality, restaurants, hotels, manufacturing. So there's a double cost involved.
How so?
Because if you or I are out, the desk is empty. We pick up our phone the next day. We clean everything up. In those industries, if you're out at a restaurant, if the server's not there, that server has to be replaced. If you're at Stop and Shop, the cashier has to be replaced. There's a double cost. So it costs me for the employee that's not there, and it costs me for the employee that has to come in and replace. And
okay,
that's our problem with that.
Got it. Steve Crawford, what's the case for question four?
Well, one of the things you said existing law. There is no existing law on sick time in Massachusetts. So what happens is, it's kind of you're on your own. There are a million people in this state, nearly a million, who don't earn a single day of paid sick time. About 450,000 don't get any sick time at all. So
A million what?
Million workers in Massachusetts do not earn a single day of paid sick time.
Okay.
About 450,000 don't get any sick time at all. They work at a fast food restaurant. They work at a coffee shop. They get sick. They don't get paid. They don't have any sick time benefits at all. If they're out for too many days, the boss said, look, either you're in or you're gone. Another 450,000 do earn paid sick time, but don't earn sick time, but they don't get paid for it.
But Steve, on its face, I think most people's initial reaction, and Bob, you can step on my hands if you disagree with this, most people's initial reaction before they hear the argument is, of course, people should either get paid or get time off, that's that sort of thing. But if it's such a wonderful idea, I was stunned about, what are there, only two states currently? Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
Connecticut and California. So if 48 states, including Massachusetts, have said, we're satisfied with the current state of affairs, one would think that it's not working as poorly as
it's operating in other states. It's been in San Francisco for years. California just passed a statewide law.
That's one of the two states.
New Jersey, right? The number of cities in New Jersey have it. Oregon, several locations have it.
But the vast majority of states don't.
Washington, D.C., New York City. But it's an issue whose time has come. I think in part it's because we are looking at universal access to health care. But I also think people recognize that it's part of our values that people should be able to take time off, and it shouldn't be just the employees who suffer when they're sick.
So, Bob, the people that are impacted, this, as you said, a lot, mm-hmm. service industry, hospitality industry, people that are not making tons of money, generally speaking. So say you get the flu and you're working as a waitress and you don't get paid for 2 weeks while you're recovering, you're in serious trouble.
Well, and again, a lot of employers will help those folks out, okay? So let's not presume that that never happens. That's first of all. But second of all,
what
mean,
when you say shift swapping, you mean
yeah.
Susie,
so in other words,
Susan
I'm out. I'm
going to
be out.
Kind of
correct. I'm
okay.
out for a couple of shifts. I yep. pick up a couple of shifts.
Okay.
That's the way it's always been handled. It's worked quite nicely. It works in all the other states except for the 48. And Jim, to your point, California just passed that law 3 weeks ago, I think now. And our problem, quite honestly, isn't with the idea of sick time for full-time employees. Our problem is with the broad brush of a ballot question, because everybody gets treated exactly the same, which means a 15-year-old teenager, you know, working his or her first job at McDonald's or Stop and Shop or at a bank, all of a sudden gets sick time, or the seasonal worker gets sick time.
Well, why don't you do this then? If you say your problem is not with the big picture, I'm putting words in your mouth, right here on the air, live, draft the ballot question for us that accommodates your concerns, if you're not against the concept that gives paid sick leave to a certain body of people but would exclude other people. How? Right. What would that be?
Actually, I think that's the problem, is that you can't do it on a ballot question because there's so many nuances that this is one of those things that really has to be dealt with.
Okay,
the
legislature comes to you today.
And we've been talking with them for a
number of years.
Well,
tell us what you said to the legislature. The legislature, the chair of the Committee on Employment and whatever mm-hmm. they call it, labor and something, says, okay, Bob Laws, I'm not going to wait till November 4th. I'm going to file something today. Tell me what to file. What do you say to them?
I think we have to look at all the different folks that you'd have to look at in terms of double payments for employers. Is, you know, for the smallest employers, is that something that they can afford to do? Mm-hmm. Probably not. I mean, the unions who've really been backing this already exempted 10 employees and down, so we're not going to pay for you don't have to pay for those.
Right, well, those are unpaid.
All of a sudden, 12 or 13 employees, they apparently have a lot of money to spend because now they have to double pay for those things. Again, these younger employees in their first and second jobs, they're learning life skills. They're learning how to call out and how to treat people with respect, coworkers, so on and so forth. I don't think as a parent, I would want my 15-year-old to have that. I want him, my daughter or my son, learning those life skills.
We're talking with Steve Crawford, who is with the Yes on 4 campaign, and Bob Laws is with the No on 4 campaign. Steve, I think what a lot of people are worried about here is abuse. They're worried that they're gonna hire somebody and they'll get their 2 weeks pay and then 2 weeks vacation, and then suddenly they're sick for 3 weeks and there's nothing you can do, and you're working, you get a small company, and you're really up against it.
Well, first of all, it's not 2 weeks, you can only earn up to 5 days, right? It is a maximum of 5 days. You can carry it over, but you can't earn more than 40. You can't cash out the money. You can't take it in the first 90 days. So if you're a bad employee and you know what you're doing as a manager, you know who's good and who's bad and how to replace those people. So we're sensitive to the abuse, the issue that Bob brings up, and I respect him, but he knows that we have shift swapping. Hard to say. Shift swapping. Written into the bill. You keep bringing it up, but it's in the bill.
What does it say?
It says if you want to swap with somebody who's this week or your next pay period, you can do that, and nobody gets hurt by it. And the reason we're going to the ballot on this question is because Bob Laws and his lobbyist friends of Beacon Hill have blocked this bill every single legislative session for the last 10 years. They've never offered one of their own. They've never even offered an amendment. And that's why we have the ballot initiative process, so we can go to the voters and get laws like this that are long overdue passed.
So what about that, Bob?
With all due respect, first
of all...
You don't
have to show all due respect. It's okay. It's just okay. A radio show. Go ahead.
No, but with all due respect, we've had a number of meetings with legislators up there because it is a very complicated thing, trying to help them understand and work through all the different nuances that would be involved when you take small business and all of a sudden bring something like this in, which, to your point, Jim, again, 49 out of 50 states up until 3 weeks ago did not mandate this. In Connecticut, they don't mandate it under employers under 50 employees, and it's up to 40 hours a week. And in California, it's only 3 days a week, and they cut out state employees. And the reason they cut out state employees was because the cost to taxpayers was going to be pretty terrific.
You know, you mentioned 50 employees a second ago, Bob Luss, who's urging a no vote on question 4, which is exactly, and I guess coincidentally, the number that was picked by Charlie Baker in his compromise. Baker says he's voting no on the ballot question. but would support a comparable question. I don't want to get into all the details, where the threshold is not when you hit the 11th employee, but when you hit the 50th. If that were the ballot question, would you support it?
Seems a lot more reasonable.
I didn't ask you that. Would you support it?
I think I would.
You would. So isn't that – well, but Steve's about to have a stroke. What's your response to that, Steve?
It's not on the ballot. It's not on the ballot. I mean, we've been working on this for 2 years.
I used to do ballot campaigns for a living. That's how I met you, Steve. So what would happen if – I know it's not on the ballot. What would happen if you today, the two of you, you went or whatever and said, hey, Mr. Speaker, hey, Mr. – I don't know if he's the Senate president yet, Rosenberg, but it was soon to be the Senate president. Mm-hmm. Bob Laws just said he'll support our bill if we raise 11 to 50. We support that too. Can we get that through the legislature
today?
But
that leaves a lot of people out. I mean, there are a lot of people struggling.
So you wouldn't agree to it? You're not crazy?
Oh, okay, fine. I mean, Bob talks about teenagers. You know, we're all lucky enough to not have to rely on a teenager's salary to help pay the rent and put food on the table. And that's the reality for thousands and thousands of families in this state. These kids are bringing home – they're not buying sneakers and iTunes. They're putting food on the table. And this happens in small cities, you know, from New Bedford to Holyoke all across this state. And that's why this is so important.
How'd you pick 11? How is 11 10. The thing – Well, no, I thought it's 11 or more, you get paid sick leave, and under 11, you get unpaid sick leave.
We were looking for a reasonable compromise for small business, and we thought that was it.
How many people, do we know the difference between, again, the Baker version, the 50 version, and the 11? Yeah, how many people get lost in the shuffle?
Again, Baker's proposal is not on the ballot.
I understand.
You know, and he distorts a lot of things. You know, the opposition likes to say this is going to have an impact on flex time. It is a lie.
Why?
Because if it says right in the bill, if you have a benefit that is equal or better to what this law provides, it's not going to impact what you have. They're trying to scare you. For all due respect, I get to use it at least once.
You can do it.
Well,
you
know, all right, yeah. No respect. You know, it is not. It's a lie, and it's designed to scare people.
Okay, Bob.
So an interesting point is I think about this now. You know, again, this is largely backed by the unions, which, again, I can appreciate. The point that Steve brings up, a lot of these unions actually have negotiated in the ability to choose between a higher wage or sick time. And so in a lot of instances, union employees will pick a higher wage. So if all of a sudden now this gets brought in, I think they're going to be able to double dip now. They've taken the higher wage, but it's going to be mandated, so they're going to have to be covered.
Wasn't the employer, if you're right, I don't know if you are or not, isn't the employer in the next negotiation going to say, okay, you just picked up X dollars through the sick leave, so as a result, you have to take a pay freeze in the next contract?
I don't think that we would be able to see that, but I don't think they ever give back wages.
Just to clarify, in my opinion, this is unions
acting. This is the yes on four sides.
Right.
Steve
unions
Crawford.
Acting. No one becomes a union member if this law passes. This is unions advocating in their best way, which is working people need the ability to call in sick and not be in danger of losing their job. That's just advocating for working people, which is what unions do best. And I think the other side is deliberately trying to distort it and make people think that everybody's going to become unions.
You know, to get back to this thing that you guys mentioned earlier about very few states having this, that does seem weird to me that it's Massachusetts, Connecticut, and California, if Massachusetts just passes. What's everybody else doing?
It works.
Washington, D.C. has had it for a long time. San Francisco's had it for a long time. And there have been studies on what the impact is in those communities. And you find that in D.C., San Francisco in particular, their economy did much better than the surrounding communities when the opponents said this is going to have a devastating impact on our economy. That's also not true.
Well, that's a good question. In Connecticut, while you say the rules are somewhat different, this is to you, Bob Luss, on the no. Mm-hmm. For a group. What's the negative fallout been, if any, from Connecticut? And California just had it recently. What's the negative fallout from Connecticut or any of these other jurisdictions like D.C. that Steve Crawford is talking about from the existence of the law that you don't want to go in place here?
The law in Connecticut is far different than what would go forward here.
But it is a paid sick leave mandate, right?
Is
anybody complaining about that? Anybody asking it to be
repealed?
Again,
I'm not involved in Connecticut, Jim.
Do you know how it's different in Connecticut?
Oh, sure. There's a bunch of differences. And again, that's our biggest problem
with
the ballot question. 50 hours, right?
Okay.
So it takes out the vast majority of small employers. Again, doesn't define a small employer as 10 or less. There's a lot of employers, as you know, between 10 and 50. Here's an interesting thing that's covered under this ballot question. Workers could come in and take it in increments as low as 1 or 2 hours. So imagine, if you will, you're out to dinner with your husband or your wife on a Friday night. It's 8 o'clock. The server gets a text and says, "Hey, I got extra tickets for the concert tonight. Can you get out of work?" That worker can just say, "I got a tickle in my throat. I'm going to take my mandated hour and a half." He's already got, or she's already got, 80% of their tips in their pocket. Why wouldn't
Bob,
he do
if
it?
If it's a good concert, come on.
Well, if it's a good concert, yeah.
Now, Steve Crawford, let's get back to this thing for a second. Obviously, you're a proponent, so you have a point of view here. What have there been attempts to repeal this Connecticut thing? What's the reaction to the existing law there?
Not to my knowledge. In fact, the opponents often say this is going to be a legal nightmare and going to create lawsuits between employers, employees, and so far they haven't been able to mention a single case where that's happened. This is a very responsible.
How long has it been there in Connecticut?
About a year and a half, two years.
So it is. This is a very responsible, well thought out ballot question that is going to provide the kind of benefit that most people in this state has, and it's also going to keep an extra $100-$150 in somebody's pocket, so that all of our neighborhoods aren't going to, neighborhoods suffer when somebody loses that kind of money. You can't buy a pizza, you can't get your hair cut. It's also important for our economy, not just for families.
So does that count as your 30-second wrap-up in favor of question four?
I'll say no.
Okay, so take 15 more seconds. Oh, you have another question?
One question. Is the same deal true for part-time as full-time workers, mm-hmm.
yes.
or is it different?
So if you work 10 hours a week for 3 weeks, you earn 1 hour of sick time. This isn't an extreme.
And it's limited for 5 days, as you said.
Correct.
Okay. Steve, you take 15 seconds because you just sort of hefted your argument, and then Bob, you can take the last 30. And then we're going to take your calls at 877 after these gentlemen leave, 301-8970. Want to hear which side you're on. Steve, take it away.
Earned sick time is about our values, but also about our economy. It's about what we want Massachusetts to represent to working people throughout the state, but it's also about keeping money in the pockets of working people so that they can spend it in their local neighborhoods and everybody can share in our economic recovery.
Bob Lowe, with all due respect, it's your turn to tell people why they should vote no.
With all due respect, I think the Boston Globe said it best. One of their opinion writers said, ballot questions are blunt instruments and not always the best way to enact complicated public policy, it goes back to the fact that this has been driven by the unions that did not show up for these hearings, and they pack the state house all the time. Yes, I was up there. I'm not going to apologize for trying to protect small business at any point. I think this is really it's less of a public policy and really a power play by the unions to help drive voter turnout and help the Democratic ticket here. The Globe even said a small circle of union strategists decided to bring the sick leave discussion to the ballot.
What's the website for Vote No and 4?
Yeah, it's www.votenoquestion4.org.
And how about you, Steve? What's the S side?
VoteYesNumeral4MA.org.
Thank you, gentlemen. We actually understand the question.
It was
now. Thank you both.
A very respectful discussion. We were hoping there might be a little bit more fisticuffs, but it's okay. Steve Crawford is spokesperson for Raise Up Massachusetts and the Yes on 4 campaign. Bob Luz is president of the Southborough-based Massachusetts Restaurant Association, and he is against the paid sick day initiative. Bob and Steve, thank you very much for coming in, and good luck in the next few days.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we're opening up the lines and asking you guys about this. How are you going to vote on question number 4? Give us your take at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Thank you both.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Well, now it's your turn. We were just getting two perspectives on ballot question 4. That's a paid sick leave initiative. Where are you in this? Would it hurt small business owners? Would it help out Bay State workers who currently lose money or maybe even their jobs if they have to call in sick? If you do not get sick pay at your workplace, we really want to hear from you. And if you run a small business, we'd really like your take as well. 877-301 8970. It's one of the major divides between Baker and Coakley. Coakley supports a ballot question. Charlie Baker opposes it but embraces the concept because, as I said, he has raised the paid sick leave, mandated paid leave, sick leave threshold in his proposed legislation to 50, but as 50 employees. But as Steve Crawford said, that particular proposal is not on the ballot. We want to know what you think.
We have a very passionate email from Scott who says, if you're sick, you shouldn't have to worry about feeding your family for a week because your greedy employers want to be billionaires while the people who can least afford it have to go without toilet paper that week. It's really disgusting.
Well, I mean, in all fairness, in response to Scott, well, his basic emotion is one I share. What Bob Lutz would say is we're not worried about the billionaires. We're worried about the small business people. And that's the primary argument against this, is the damage it allegedly would do to small businesses. The good news, I think, for the proponents is there appear to be no screaming about the Connecticut law. The bad news for the proponents is virtually none of America, which stuns me. Were you not shocked when you heard that?
Yes, I was shocked.
Virtually none of America guarantees that a sick employee get paid or even unpaid sick leave. 877-301-8970. How are you planning on voting? Or if you're undecided, why undecided? Give us a buzz.
Let's start with Sean in Boston. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Sean.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have a quick question about, you're talking about how most of this is for service industry people, like waiters and bartenders, but their hourly wage is like $1.70.
Oops.
So
whoops.
If I get a sick day paid, the employer's only paying me like $40 anyways, tops.
Great point. I don't know what the answer is, but I would assume that I would guess, but I don't know this, that the tipping that you would likely get would not be included in whatever pay. But I'm embarrassed to say we should have asked that question of the proponent and opponent. Good point, Sean. Thank you for the call. By the way, Lisa in Boston, I don't know how we got this, either called up and hung up or tweeted, wants to mention she believes it's a public health issue. She's eaten at cafes, as have I, by the way, with sick servers. I don't mean sick like deathly sick, but people are coughing or sneezing or something because apparently they didn't want to take
the day
off.
I don't think most people take the days off when they have colds.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, except when you eat at a restaurant, I don't think you want the person sneezing in your chicken noodle soup.
No, you don't want them sneezing in your chicken noodle soup. But, you know, as someone who's worked in a restaurant, what goes on behind closed doors in restaurants, you can't even imagine. You don't have to worry about people sneezing on your food.
That's
sort of the least of your worries. Kevin from Marlborough. What do you think, Kevin?
Hi, Kevin. Kevin? Kevin, we'll put you on hold. We'll get back to you in a minute.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry.
Hi.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I just wanted to address the comment that, you know, only service industry employers would be, you know, sort of getting double dipped by this issue. I mean, I'm a salaried employee. I get paid time off. I'm a software engineer. And it occurred to me that, sure, my employer has to pay me when I'm sick, but they're also losing revenue because of the work that I'm not accomplishing, which is another form of double dipping. And I just wanted to know what your guests had to say about that.
Well, I can say what I have to say to it, which is it's a cost of doing business. There are a lot of things. I'm sure what you say is true in your particular setting. And I'm sure that what Bob Lutz said is true about restaurants, which he represents. But the bottom line is, should something that a lot of people consider to be a pretty basic benefit be something that employers have to take into account? Yeah, it's going to cost them something, like paying your employees costs you something. But should that be part of the cost of doing business? And I think you can make a pretty strong case for that. Obviously, you and Bob Lutz and others disagree. But Kevin, thank you much for the call. Now let's go to Worcester, where Carolyn is on the phone. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello.
Hi.
I was listening to Mr. Lutz, and I said we are certainly in the new gilded age. It sounded his argument sounded absolutely archaic. And what he was saying is, well, the unions, by their not showing up on Beacon Hill, are suspect. But I, of course, went to Beacon Hill, so I'm not suspect. And who's paying him? I mean, the unions represent the
Well, he said, no, he said, we introduced him. He's from this Southboro-based restaurant association. He's not trying to hide anything.
Right. He's lobbying for them, obviously.
Well, but by maligning the unions, I was a union member. I'm retired now. And thank God I had sick time. There were times when I just could not go to work because I was ill. And I can't imagine people that have to lose money, you know, because they're ill. I used to work for MCAD. And
Mass Commission Against Discrimination, we should say. Yeah, go ahead.
And occasionally I would get a complaint where somebody had been fired because they took sick time, period.
Well, that's one of Steve Crawford's arguments, that people do get fired for taking sick time, and that's part of the reason they got this.
And of course, a lot of times they had no recourse, basically, because everyone who took sick time at that place was fired, so there was no discrimination. It was just unfair, but it wasn't covered by the law.
Carolyn, you know, thank you for the call.
I hate to be so cynical, but if you're the Restaurant Association, think of all the whining and dining you can do for the legislators to persuade them to be on your side.
Well, on that note, you know, Steve Crawford made the charge against the vote no on four side that they have lobbied the legislature into taking no action on this. Are you not stunned that a liberal-leaning, allegedly, wholly Democratic legislature would have resisted through the years mandating paid sick leave, or at minimum mandating unpaid sick leave?
Well, like I said, a lot of great restaurants around.
No, and obviously that has had some influence.
You know, the new places down the south, down by the ICA. You know, what do
yeah, but aren't you the one that always tells me the unions run everything on Beacon Hill? Aren't you the one that says that? Well, the unions, not just the ballot question, would have strongly believed in this forever. The labor movement.
Well, it's one particular union, Jim, that drives me nuts. It's not all of them.
Okay, fine. Let's go to.
Here's a good one from Jesse. He says many parents knowingly send sick children to school because they can't stay home. That is really true.
Totally true.
Really true. You see that all the time. And then the parents, you know, the kid's got 101 fever and the teacher's trying to find the parent. I used to hear stories about parents not answering the phone because they couldn't get out of work to come pick up their kids. So they just let them
I
sit
believe
in, the,
that.
In the nurse's office.
You know, by the way,
day.
You know, as Steve Crawford wisely said twice when I suggested, wouldn't this compromise the Charlie Baker / agreed upon compromise with the restaurant people work, raising it to 50. And Steve said, well, we don't support that and it's not on the ballot. But isn't it amazing on an issue this basic that Beacon Hill can't come to a compromise? Okay, you say it's going to hurt small business, restaurant people and other people. What's the threshold? What's the number of employees where the damage would be minimalized? Let's start with that. I'm talking about not with the ballot question, but a year ago, 5 years ago. 30? Okay, let's start at 30. Steve Crawford, you say that's not enough. Let's see if 30 isn't enough, and then we'll revisit it. It is amazing to me that this thing even had to go to the ballot.
I think that there's this idea that people are going to abuse it, at which Steve Crawford said—
By the way, anybody can abuse sick leave.
Well, he said you can't, really, because you only can get 5 days. It's 1 hour for every 30 hours work with a maximum of 5 days. So,
but that's been the line about sick leave forever. You shouldn't give sick leave to anybody because they may abuse it. Well, a good manager— more often than not, doesn't allow for abuse. I mean, that's ridiculous.
I do think I remember getting the flu once, and I was really sick for about a week.
And what's your point?
My point is that—
Where were you working
the,
then?
If you get the flu, I was working at my other radio
And you
station.
Got paid, right?
Yes, I did.
Well, I know. Okay, fine.
And you had to carry the load all by yourself.
I did.
You rose to the occasion heroically.
Best shows we ever did, most people think. Actually, they weren't, to be perfectly honest. They were pretty horrible.
Okay.
Maura, you're in North Attleboro. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about question four, the sick leave question. Hi, Maura.
Hi, guys. I work at an assisted living place as an LPN, a nurse, and I pass out meds for 4 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
When I originally started there in May, one company owned it. Well, now another company owns it, and anybody that works less than 30 hours has no earned sick time anymore.
Wow. Well, you will if this passes, Maura, so you better get yourself—
Wait a second. You had it, and the employer took it away?
Yeah. Well, the employer that bought the place out.
What did the new employer say as to why he or she was eliminating the benefit?
Well, that's the way their company has always run it.
Mm.
So our
part-time
company that used to own it was, you know, more generous.
Yeah.
Even part-timers would get, when I started there, even the part-timers got earned sick time and vacation time. But now we don't get any of that because the new owner came in and they're using their corporate rules, as opposed to what we used to have.
Makes a real happy workplace, doesn't it, taking away the benefit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're working. I mean, I'm a nurse. There are aides that help people. You know, they're in close physical contact, and they don't make a whole ton of money, maybe $13 an hour. And if they take a sick day, they're not eating.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
That's a pretty powerful argument in favor, Maura. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I have a husband with a good paycheck.
Oops. I'm lucky. I have a husband who, what'd you say?
With a good job.
With a good paycheck. But a lot of people don't.
That's correct. Maura, thank you for the call.
Okay, Art from West Bridgewater is not impressed. He says if they mandate sick time, they should mandate proof of illness to use it. Ends the whole issue about abuse. And he also wants to know why we didn't ask Carolyn from the MCAD how old she was when she retired. How many sick days she accumulated. Well, that is one of the things that a lot of these state agencies, you know, I'm always amazed when someone retires from someplace like Massport. they accumulated 975 days of vacation and 475 sick days. And you always think, wow, did they work nonstop for 30 years?
No, some of those payouts. But in all fairness, mostly to top executives. The average run-of-the-mill employee at Massport is not leaving with that.
They never took Christmas vacation. They never took Thanksgiving, the Friday after Thanksgiving. It's amazing, that work ethic. And not only did they get the time, but they get paid for it.
You know what I loved about those stories, by the way? Not only did I love the fact that they're leaving with like 2 years of sick or vacation.
Years. It's
I loved, and with public money.
And you can roll it
I
over.
Love when they were asked by a reporter from the Globe or the Herald, would you like to comment on you going home with 2 years of paid sick leave and whatever, their position would be, no, I would not like to respond to
they
the public
not,
about using
no,
the public
comment,
money.
And they can roll it over.
Bob from Framingham called. I guess he had to go. Yes, he
twice
did.
Twice or three times already?
Well, obviously they can carry it over. Or they wouldn't have 2 years of sick leave. Bob from Framingham is a construction worker. He was in his car. He wants to say he's voting no on question four because I guess the point that we were discussing before, he thinks people will take advantage of the benefit, but I think that's in the hand of the manager. He or she has got to run his place if this becomes law appropriately.
John from Plymouth. What do you think, John?
Well, since I called, I've had a lot of additional things to listen to and think about, but I'll try and stay on what I called about.
Sure.
The consumer also is hurt because all these mandates that are put on business, it's not as though they just absorb it all, that they're all extremely rich, lead low-stress lives, don't work 90 hours a week. And I'm not a small businessman, but I know some. And that's their life. They have a lot of stress. They have a lot of trouble with employees. They pay a lot of taxes. And if you noticed, over the years, cost of things have gone up and up and up. So I'm not in favor of intervening in what should be a free market system. And to the point that the gentleman made, it may sound strange.
Whoa, don't wait. Before you continue, John, you don't want to intrude into a free market system. Does that mean there should be no rules about what employers can do with their employees, and it's a one-on-one? You get the best deal. Well, what is appropriate? Like health and safety things?
I think we have to be very careful to keep adding on and acting like it has no consequences for the consumer. Just like those state employees who are public employees. And I think people understand that the unfunded pension liabilities we have, and a lot of these are public employer unions, are a huge problem facing this country. There are going to be serious consequences to these. Of course, now, I don't want a six-year-old working in a hot kitchen with boiling water and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when people act like it's the 1% just have all this money and taking it from them as a virtue – is living in a
fantasy. But John, in all fairness, the argument from the opponent here was not at all about the 1% or the 2% or the 3%. It was about small business owners who were, for the most part, not there. And I also think people would be naive to suggest, let's just take the restaurants, which is his primary concern. Obviously, it costs more to employ Jane Doe, the likelihood is good that the meal's going to cost more. But the question, I think, for the voter is that a reasonable thing? Should you, the customer, not expect, or should you expect, to bear some burden to make sure that Jane Doe can get paid sick leave? I mean, that's really the question. No one should.
That has an economic consequence.
Of course, it does. John, thank you for the call.
Time for one more quick one?
We do.
Denise from New Bedford. We only have about 40 seconds left, Denise.
Hi, Denise.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Hi. I also voting yes on question four. It's just our country's mentality. You compare it to European countries, we work like crazy. I don't know. It's just.
By the way, Denise, on that note, we get less vacation in this country than virtually any other Western nation.
Right.
And to make it worse, we take less of the virtually no vacation we get than any other country. So I think your comparison.
Yeah.
Has validity.
Have you ever seen that commercial? I don't even know what they were advertising. It basically like comparing us to other countries in Europe. Oh, they get all these vacations. They do all this. We just work hard, and then we have all these things.
Yeah, we do.
That's right.
We have a lot of things.
And then you
and
drop
have things.
Dead.
Denise,
I think
thanks for
a judge,
the call.
We should all be judges. Don't they get 8 weeks vacation?
Oh, God.
They get through every day at 4 o'clock. Missed your opportunity there, Jim. You're a lawyer. Okay, thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Ask This Old House. Tom Silva and Richard Trethewey will be here to take your calls. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas will also be here for her take on how the United States is fighting against the Islamic State. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
And keep in mind, we will end the show tomorrow at 2, 5 hours later on Channel 2 and on 89.7 FM, the first one-to-one gubernatorial debate. The Globe and WGBH sponsored. Marjorie and I will be the moderators.
I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for listening, and please tune in again tomorrow.